Stargazing doesn't have to be boring. Not when you study sports stars. This is Sportsnet Tonight on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Tonight, I'm gonna have myself a real good time. I feel alive.
Welcome to Sportsnet tonight on Sportsnet 590, The Fan and the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm your host, Matt Marchese, and alongside me, my co-host, Josh Goldberg. Follow us on Twitter at MattSN590 and at JGoldberg12. Our producer tonight is the lovely and talented Mark Boffo, and our technical operator, keeping the CRTC off our back, Josh Santos. Josh, firstly, how are you doing tonight?
I'm excellent, pal. What's going on? Looking forward to it. First opportunity to really dive into the Blue Jays stuff. You know me, I'm a big Jays guy, just in general. Twitter, I've shared my thoughts, but I'm looking forward to doing that. And obviously, I know you probably have some thoughts on Sid Sixero, and so do I, and obviously Tim and Sid as an intern on that show. A lot of great moments. They showed me what it meant to build a great show and what went into it day after day after day, the hard work, the creativity, the drive that those guys, you know, showed every single day, and they pushed each other for so many years. A bittersweet day for a lot of us who know those guys well, but certainly bigger and brighter things, I think, for both of them in the future.
Yeah, and you know what? There's lots that we can get to today, but let's start off with that. And if you haven't heard the news, Tim and Sid, their last show together will be February 26th. Sid will begin his new role on Breakfast Television on March 10th. And I was here when both of them were hired. I remember how big of a deal it was to bring them into the fold on The Fan when they were doing 1-4. And I was lucky enough, as you were, to, you know, you were a little bit more involved, but I was able to be around them a lot because I was basically at the station all day. It's changed over time, but, you know, I was producing Hockey Central and Primetime Sports, so I got to interact with them a lot over the course of the day, and they both offer differing opinions on things, but just to kind of sit and pick their brain about stuff and being able to be around them, it was so invaluable. Like you just can't, you know, I'm fortunate to say that I've worked with some of the best sports broadcasters that this country's ever seen in my almost 10 years in this business, or 9.5 or whatever it is. It's been a long time. And you know, both guys close enough to me that, you know, I feel like I could reach out to them at any point, ask for advice, or just have a conversation with them about anything. So, like you said, it is bittersweet to see this end, but, you know, like you mentioned as well, brighter things upon the horizon for both of them. And as we know, Tim will continue on in his role doing 5-7 after Sid is gone, and Sid will take on a big role with Breakfast Television, something that he's been looking forward to by the sounds of it. So lots that we can talk about, but just, you can share a story or anything about your time interning on the show and just kind of what those guys mean to you and your career.
Well, I remember, you know, pretty early on, they just kind of told me what was expected of me, you know, finding stories, Twitter, that sort of stuff, gathering audio. And, you know, instead of just like making it a thing where they could, I guess, just give me instructions and then not really, you know, do much else, it's like, oh, well, you're involved. They were checking in. You know, we were having conversations. They were open to ideas. They always gave credit. You know, they encouraged me to bring ideas to the table, you know, even if they probably weren't going to get used in any way, shape, or form. You just felt like you were a part of the process. And as somebody who was, you know, just out of college for radio and looking – like crazy to get a job and hopefully get a job. You know, I wasn't expecting to get a job right out of college in this market, but I definitely think the work that I did and being somebody who those guys for a handful of months relied on went a long way to me ultimately, you know, getting hired on over 6 years ago here at the Fan. I'm still here, and I certainly don't forget that was probably a big reason why I am where I am today. And they've always been really gracious with their time. And if I ever have a question, they're always open to give me some advice or answer it. Sometimes they'll just, you know, in the days when we were in the office, they would come up, we would, you know, kind of shoot the breeze a little bit, check in on see how things were doing. They were always supportive. Both were really supportive when I started, you know, doing on-air stuff. They were both very, very good to me. Basically from the moment I met them back in the summer of 2014. And it's a shame, it's sad we won't see Sid around the office anymore, and we won't be able to see him doing his thing on Tim and Sid, but it'll be exciting to see him in a different, I guess, avenue of media, not solely focused on sports, getting to use his personality and a sense of humor and being entertaining on breakfast television. And I'm definitely curious to see what Tim comes up with, whoever he's working with. I'm sure it'll be a bunch of different people for now, whoever it is in the future, different ideas, different type of show. But, you know, knowing the way that those two guys are and how they work and how they can adjust, I wouldn't expect anything but great things from them.
Yeah, and we've both talked about what they've both meant to us in our, you know, path to where we are today. And I remember specifically Tim telling me, you know, I was basically the intern on Primetime Sports, and at that point I was, you know, pretty much helping to produce shows. Ryan Walsh was the producer at the time, but he had to take off for some reason on a Friday, and I ended up having to produce a show on a Friday as an intern. It wasn't that hard, but, you know, as a 22-year-old intern or 23-year-old intern, you know, it's pretty daunting working on that show. And Tim came up and just said, hey, you know, you did a good job. I was like, I'm just an intern or whatever. And he said, don't ever think that you're not important. Don't ever think that you don't play a role. And that kind of resonated with me, because that's the type of stuff that you pass on to other people who are trying to get into the business. And I can't even tell you the countless funny moments that we've had with those guys. And I can actually tell a story on the air. He probably doesn't even know that this happened, but it was during the Euro Cup. I can't even remember how many years ago, and Portugal was playing. And you can imagine what Sid is like during a Portugal game while he's on the air. Little did he know that I had a remote in my hand, because as you know, there's multiple Rogers boxes around the building, right? And what ended up happening was I got a hold of a remote, and as the game started to progress, I would go by unknowingly to Sid and turn off the screen during his show while the Portugal game was on. I have never seen a person get so angry in my life. To that, like, he was absolutely livid. And Sid, if you're listening, yeah, that was me, so I apologize. I also saw him jump on Jeff Blair's back after Germany scored a goal against Italy because he didn't want to see Italy win. Like, it was, we've had some moments. There's stuff that we can't even talk about on the air. But, you know, it's been a ride. You know, when there was rumors that they were going to come over and join the Fan, I remember thinking about how great of an addition that was to our lineup. Like, those two guys were, you knew who they were. It was just when you thought about the score, or even before that, Headline Sports, it was Tim and it was Sid. And then there were others, but those were the guys that kind of stood the test of time, as we could tell, because they're still here today. So to both of those guys, thank you for what you've brought to this station. Thank you for what you've brought to this market. But I think I'm speaking on behalf of both of us, Josh, and thank you what you've done for us and the others that have worked with you, or, you know, worked by you. You guys have done a lot for us, and it's just the mere presence and making us feel like we're important. I think that goes a long way in this business, and it goes without saying that they're going to be missed being together, but there's a bright future here for both of them.
No question. Very, very well said. And, you know, I guess for all the fans out there who have followed them for so many years, really enjoy, drink in, savor the last, right, 4 or 5 weeks here, you know, because this is it. This is their last run. And it's going to be definitely exciting to see what they have cooked up. I'm sure there's going to be all sorts of exciting, different, crazy stuff for them to really send them out with the farewell that they so richly deserve.
For sure. And I am there's no real easy segue, but there are things going on in sports right now. And, you know, Josh, the one thing, and we talked about this before this show started, and it leads to our question for today's show. With what you've seen so far, would you like to see the Canadian division continue after this season? Our poll question is on Twitter. You can check it out at MattSN590, at JGoldberg12, at Fan590. You can also tweet us or send us your text with your name and location to 590-590. We'll read them out. My initial first blush at this is I like it, and I think you know, we can add the caveat here, like, we want to see the Canadian division, or at least I do, but it's got to be, you know, you play other teams, whether it's, you know, your conference, or you play every team in the East, or however they do the divisions. You play one division 1 year, kind of like the NFL has done with their schedule, where you don't play everybody, but you play almost everybody. So I would like to see that type of schedule for it, but I really like the idea of these Canadian teams playing. Heck, it's good for ratings. I think it's good for the game because, you know, when you're talking about ratings, I don't know how well a Canadian team draws in the U.S. when we're talking about TV numbers. So I think there's a lot to be said about this. It doesn't look like it's going to happen, but I certainly don't think it's the worst idea in the world right now.
So, I don't think it's the worst idea in the world. The reason that I voted a no on this is because, you know, considering the circumstances of this season and how, you know, the borders closed and everything that is going on, it made sense. It was the easier move. You know, nothing's easy these days, but it was the lower risk, the obvious choice, as opposed to, you know, cross-border, which was not an option. So I was totally good with it this year, and it has been an exciting start so far, and it seems like it's going to be probably pretty tightly packed, potentially 1 through 7, but, you know, very likely 1 through 6. There's going to be a lot of jockeying for position and a lot of exciting games and a lot of playoff atmosphere for a regular season that usually has a lot of rough games, you know, especially 82, your average Tuesday night against the Nashville Predators or Minnesota Wild or something like that, if you're the Toronto Maple Leafs, hasn't been the most exciting in the past. We've seen the Maple Leaf crowd, you know, there's always the joke made, well, this is what you get on a Tuesday night with a team like that. You're not getting that this year. You're getting intensity. Even if the games aren't all great, like last night's game stunk, and we'll get into it, I'm sure, a little bit more. But the reason I don't think it's something that I want to see beyond just this year is because, hey, there's something, you know, exciting for fans, young and old and everything in between, to get an opportunity to see every other team in the NHL come into your arena. And so if you're a Maple Leafs fan, you get a couple of opportunities or, you know, one opportunity, depending if it's a Western Conference team, to see somebody like, you know, Nathan MacKinnon or Sidney Crosby or Ovechkin or some of the other great players in the National Hockey League. And as great as the ratcheted up intensity of an all-Canadian division would be, especially if we're talking 82 games, like if you extrapolate this out over 82 games and you're basically only playing your division for 82 games, that's a lot different. You're talking about, you know, 15 or so meetings or more in some cases potentially, instead of, you know, 9 or 10. It's considerably more. And I understand, you know, there's lots that goes into it, revenue, TV numbers, all of that. But I just think the variety of seeing every team. Yeah, there are exceptions. There are some bad games on the schedule that, you know, if you had something else going on, maybe you're not clearing your schedule to watch the Maple Leafs play, you know, the New Jersey Devils or something like that. But I think it's part of the fabric these days of the National Hockey League that you get an opportunity to see every team in the league, you know, a couple of times. You go there once, they come to you once, and I like it. I'm used to it. I am drinking this thing in for the 56 games this year, the one season we're going to get it, and I think it's going to be great. But I'm looking forward to going back to the status quo and getting the usual divisional matchups and seeing the teams in the West Coast, you know, seeing the Vegas Golden Knights a couple times a year going forward.
So I think we're kind of on the same page here, because I don't think that you can do the Canadian division where you're only playing those teams for 82 games. That's crazy to me. I do like the idea of playing other teams, and I think you could kind of get away with, you know, you play your division, you know, 8 times each, and my math isn't good, but whatever, 8 times each, and then you play, you know, the rest of the teams in your conference, however they do that, you play them, you know, 2 times each, and then you play the other conference once, and you alternate every year home and away. I think that feels like the way that you do it. I think that's the best way. I just love the idea of rivalries, Josh. I feel like the league has gotten away from it. Don't you remember how much fun it was to watch those Leafs Senators playoff series? And maybe that's because of the way the game itself has changed. It's not nearly as rough and tumble as it used to be. A lot of these guys, they like each other. They don't hate each other. They may, you know, have a slight dislike when they don't play an opponent. But a lot of these guys train together. They go to events together. It's more of a friendly thing than anything. Sure, a guy will piss another guy off and stuff starts to happen, but generally speaking, that's not how the game is played. You know, like I'm watching Flyers Bruins right now, and those were two teams that you could guarantee would be an absolute war when they played each other. It's not nearly the same thing. So I think there's lots that go into it, but I just love the idea of building up some hatred, getting some bad blood between two teams. And maybe we'll see that this season. Maybe Edmonton and Calgary will piss each other off again, and we'll have the Battle of Alberta return. I think that's what I would like to see. So I think that's where my head is going with creating these rivalries, or recreating these rivalries, and trying to get that going, because then when it comes time for playoffs, there's a backstory. Like, maybe this is the wrestling fan in me, but I like to have some drama when teams play. I like the storylines that go into it. So I don't know where you feel, where you are on that, but I think that's kind of where I would like to see it go, with a little bit of a balanced schedule in terms of playing teams in your conference, and then, you know, maybe playing, you know, the Vegas and Colorado and teams like that, you play them once as opposed to twice home and home, and you just alternate every year.
Yeah, there's something to be said for that. I think I still do like the idea of every, you know, fan base getting an opportunity pretty much to see every team in the NHL every season. I understand, you know, the downside to, I guess, that is, you know, the ratcheting up of the intensity, the rivalries, and that sort of thing that you're getting at if you place more of an emphasis on interdivisional play and interconference play. So I totally see that. I'm still of the mind that I like to see every team come into Toronto, and I like to see Toronto, especially, like, if you're a Leafs fan out in Los Angeles or something like that, and there are Leafs fans in every NHL city, and maybe it's not the best example because Leafs fans are everywhere. You want that opportunity every single year to see the team that you cheer for come to the market that you happen to live in, right? You're always excited to put your sweater on and go and cheer on your team. It's the one opportunity you get a year. So I still think I'm in favor of it, but your plan and your strategy and your way to try and get things heated up a little bit when it comes to conference and division totally works too. But I really wonder what the thought process is going to be, what they're going to base everything on. Is it going to be just TV and money and numbers? I would assume most likely. I guess everything at this point is going to somehow tie into the next American TV rights deal and what that looks like.
Yeah, that plus travel is going to be a big one. Like, you know, I don't think the NHL necessarily loves the idea of, well, the teams do, of traveling. Let's say it's the Leafs. They travel out west. They play Vancouver, you know, 2 times back-to-back or whatever, and then they come back and they'll play, let's say, Edmonton 2 times on their way back. I know they don't love the idea of lengthy road trips, only because it's, you know, the teams are away for a long time, and season ticket holders don't love that, from what I understand. Not that I am one, but like, I get it. You don't have a game for 2 weeks, and then you have 3 in 5 days type thing. So yeah. I understand it from that perspective. So there's a lot of logistical things that are clearly way above our pay grade. But if you want to weigh in, feel free. Text us at MattSN590, at JGoldberg12, at Fan590. We have a poll question up. With what you've seen so far, do you want to see the Canadian division return next year and the seasons going forward? I think I have hell no, or hell yes, nah, and too early to tell. So be sure to send us a note, and you can also text us with your name and your location at 590-590. Coming up after the break, Josh Clipperton from the Canadian Press will join us. Lots of stuff going on at Leaf practice today. No Joe Thornton. Austin Matthews left early. Nick Robertson hits the LTIR. Who played with who? What are we going to see tomorrow? We're going to try and get all those questions answered when we come back. This is Sportsnet Tonight on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and the Sportsnet Radio Network. Welcome back to Sportsnet Tonight on Sportsnet 590, The Fan and the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm your host, Matt Marchese. Alongside me, my co-host, Josh Goldberg. And joining us on the line from the Canadian Press is Josh Clipperton. Josh, how are you doing tonight?
Very good, guys. How are you?
Good, good. We all knew that this season was going to be a difficult one because there was going to be guys that would test positive for COVID. There were going to be injuries. You just don't think that it's going to happen this early, or at least you hope it wouldn't. And now we see Nick Robertson hit the LTIR. Joe Thornton was hurt last night. And then Austin Matthews left practice for, you know, whatever reason. But if there was ever a season where having depth would be important, was it always going to be this one?
Yeah, no, for sure. I think that, and that's why you obviously have the taxi squads, but teams prepared as best they could for this. I mean, you never know what's going to happen, and you know, you can only control so much when it comes to injuries, and you can only control so much when it comes to COVID. You can take all the precautions, but as we know, it's insidious, and it can get places even if you're taking, you know, all the precautions that are out there. So yeah, these teams are all coming into this knowing that this was a possibility and a likelihood that they'd be down 1, 2, 3, 4 guys at certain times, and the Leafs are dealing with this now as the injury bug has bit them early.
Yeah, it's jarring to me, especially, you know, with Matthews uncertain for tomorrow night, you know, how thin all of a sudden the Maple Leafs look without Joe Thornton and Nick Robertson. And as I was thinking that, we were talking about a 41-year-old and somebody who wasn't initially on the opening night roster, but I see the bottom six and I really wonder, you know, are the Leafs going to be able to get enough scoring, or are they just going to have to hope that their top six and that core four of forwards just carries them night in and night out?
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. You make a good point about the bottom six. I'm looking over my notes from the practice today, and yeah, it does look thin. I mean, you got Barabanov, Engvall, and Spets on the fourth line all of a sudden. I mean, we don't know what's going to happen with Austin for tomorrow, like you mentioned, and we're not sure if they're going to go 11-7. I imagine they'll go 12-6 again, just because of what we saw what happened when they had 10 forwards last night. You know, they're very thin at that point. But yeah, no, it'll be fascinating to see tomorrow at the morning skate. If Matthews is out there, and if he's not, what happens? Is it Kerfoot that gets pushed up? Is it Spezza? You know, we've seen Nylander in the past play center. I'm not suggesting that's how. I'm just throwing out ideas here, but it's going to be really interesting. You're right. All it takes is one or two guys to go down for you to feel like, you know, things are getting pretty slim.
Josh, last night, it's like everybody was waiting for this juggernaut offensive matchup. It looked like, you know, everybody wanted to see 1,000 goals scored, and it was one of those things. And the air came out of that balloon really fast last night because it was a terrible game. It was slow. It was not nearly as offensive as we were hoping. What it kind of looked like to me was they were two teams that were scared to make a mistake last night.
Yeah, no, for sure. Sheldon Keefe today sort of touched on that. There was two teams that that had scouted each other pretty well and were very respectful of each other's teams and each other's talent and each other's, you know, strong points. And they were not willing to go out on a limb, especially when, you know, Edmonton goes down 1-0. They're playing their first road. Edmonton goes up 1-0. Excuse me. They're playing their first road game since March. So they're, you know, they've lost 3 of 4 at home. So they're really committed to their structure. And then Toronto obviously knows, you know, McDavid and Matt and Draisaitl. You all remember what McDavid did on that ice last year, and the 6-4 game that even brought the great one out of his seat. So I think you're right. They're both sides were very timid, cautious, if you will. And you know, one of the only good things is I wrote in my story was that no one had to pay to get in the building, because you know those tickets would have been pretty expensive in a regular year. I was contractually obligated to be there, but I think I probably would have changed the channel if I was watching at home.
Well, to me, it seems like the Leafs right now are kind of caught in between, where they know they need to play more responsible and more structured just top to bottom, but they're a team that, you know, prides itself on possessing the puck and using their speed and skill and generating lots of chances, but the two sort of clash. So do you think that they're just still trying to maybe find that happy medium that can bring out the best in what they do while also, I guess, kind of covering up some of the issues that they've had in the past?
Yeah, for sure. It's definitely like a fine balance. That was sort of one of the lines of questioning today after practice, was how do you get that balance? Because, you know, you're not going to play Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl every night, but you're going to play them a lot this season, and you're going to play good players on all these Canadian teams, as we've already seen. You know, there's lots of stars north of the border. So how do you balance that, you know, system structure versus, you know, neutering yourself going forward? And I think that team is, you know, the Leafs are still looking – I mean, it's still early, but they're trying to figure out the happy balance, the happy medium, the happy balance, if you will, of how that works and what that looks like. Because, you know, we know what this team can do going forward, and we know what they can do when they go forward and they don't take care of their own end. So, you know, it's one of those things that Sheldon Keefe and the coaches are going to be, you know, going over and hammering home and trying to figure out what the right tonic is and what the right formula is. Because, you know, last night wasn't it. You know, defensively it was, but you obviously need a lot more going forward, you know, as the season progresses.
Josh Clipperton, national hockey writer for the Canadian Press, joins us on Sportsnet tonight. And Josh, just to kind of reiterate the point that my co-host was trying to make, how much does the lack of a preseason and get, like, in a year that, you know, is going to be, you better figure out how good you are in a hurry, because if you don't, you're going to be in trouble. Not having a preseason, how much of that has an effect on this Leaf team really not knowing what their identity is at this point?
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely part of it. You know, train camp was 10, 11 days. You know, they were off the ice for one of those days as well. No preseason, like you mentioned. Usually you have 6 to 8 preseason games. You get a chance to see guys. You get a chance to put guys in different spots. We would know a lot more about Mikko Lehtonen, right now than we would, you know, after his two performances where he hasn't really been given, you know, much of a chance. Obviously a bit more of a chance yesterday. So for sure, I mean, we would have, maybe Nick Robertson, you know, we know he's hurt, but maybe he finds his way, you know, into the original four group if there's a preseason. There's all these things, the teams are doing all this sort of on the fly. No one's ever done this before. So yeah, there's going to be mistakes, there's going to be hiccups, and I guess you just do the best you can, because, you know, every night is a new challenge, and, you know, these games come fast and furious. There's not a lot of time to practice. You know, they can meet, they can go over things, but you kind of are just, you know, doing it as you go, because there just isn't that same preparation time that there normally would have been, and even during the season, there's not a lot of time to sit back and reassess and reevaluate for long stretches, because you got to play the next night.
So we're just, I guess, about a year into Sheldon Keefe's NHL coaching career, and obviously he's had a lot to deal with the pandemic shutdown, and then obviously the bubble, and, you know, this crazy season. But I guess, what do you think we've sort of learned about what Sheldon Keefe is as a coach, and maybe what he can be and where he wants to be as he continues to really get his feet settled as a coach of the Leafs?
Yeah, no, he's definitely had quite the year, like the rest of us. And none of it's been normal. I think what we see is he wants to possess the puck. I mean, he wants to his team to be one that goes forward, but also is responsible defensively, like we talked about earlier. I don't think it's any secret, and it's been written about, you know, by myself and many others, that him and Kyle Dubas share a similar or near identical view of how the game should be played. You know, the jury is still out, though, on how that translates into results, and whether this team is tough enough, whether a team can be gritty enough in those tough moments, in terms of, you know, their defensive acumen, like we mentioned. You know, he's definitely hammers home the point, though, to us in the media. Like, when something's not right, he's happy to mention who was on the ice when something went wrong. He's happy to mention, you know, where their shortcomings are. So there's no hiding. And I think that that's something that everyone should appreciate. You know, we have always appreciate honesty, and there's no hiding from things. But like anything, first year coach, and it's such a crazy year. We don't really know everything yet. The story is obviously far from being written.
Yeah, it's funny that you talk about like the accountability, because it's not that this team lacked that, but I wonder how much more they are listening to Sheldon Keefe when it comes to, you know, when he talks to the media. These guys can hear that kind of stuff coming from Sheldon Keefe, and I wonder how much more that resonates with him as opposed to having Mike Babcock behind the bench.
Yeah, I think with Mike, like I was only here for about a year and a half of Mike's tenure, and he, I got the sense that you know, he definitely used the media as well, but I think sometimes it was more needling guys. Like it wasn't so much constructive, whereas I think when Sheldon talks, sometimes it can be constructive. Like he's almost talking to a player or to the team about something, knowing that it'll get back to them, or, you know, we know these guys read, we know these guys listen, even though they say they don't. So I think that's an interesting, difference between the two coaches is that, you know, every time Sheldon speaks, I think it's with a purpose and a meaning. Not that Mike didn't have meaning and purpose in his dealings with the media, but I think Sheldon's also, you know, it's just on a different level, if you will, about what he's trying to get across and what the purpose of it is. You know, it's teaching as opposed to maybe, you know, some of the things that Mike Babcock would have said.
I'm curious, you know, we see Pierre Engvall is looking like he's going to draw into the lineup for the first time, really, this season, tomorrow night, as a fourth-line center with Barabanov and Spezza. And, you know, Sheldon Keefe was very supportive of Engvall last year, and Engvall just didn't perform and hasn't been performing for the better part of a calendar year, but he's going to get an opportunity. How long do you think the leash is, though, if he doesn't show what the coaching staff and what maybe Kyle Dubas is looking for? Is this maybe something one or two games? If he doesn't show it, he's back out and then they go to somebody else?
Yeah, no, I wouldn't be surprised if that was the case at all, because, you know, like you said, his leash has been pretty long for the last little while. They gave him a contract that was probably above market value and what maybe he deserved considering his experience, and he's obviously not lived up to it, and especially in the flat cap world, that you know, is even more glaring. It's not like, you know, the salary cap's gone up $4 or $5 million, and it doesn't really matter as much. You know, this is a guy that you would expect to be on the roster and producing, and he's not. So, and then I think he gets a couple chances if these injuries do force their hand. But, you know, like you mentioned, there's Adam Brooks, there's Anderson was in the practice today on the taxi squad. So I imagine the leash is fairly short. You know, these points are important. You know, 1-2-3 game, you know, 2-3-4 game losing streaks can really cost you even early. So, you know, the time is already pressing. I mean, you don't want to, we always say it's early, but at the same time, you know, every win, every loss is worth, you know, about 1.5 compared to other years. So they don't have time to mess around.
This team defensively has looked different, as we know. And I wonder how much of it is the personnel. I wonder how much of it is just the attention to the detail. But in the same breath, when you look at this team overall and you talk about, you know, comparisons from this year to last year, both defensively and offensively, I would say this team is better put together. It is a better team all around. Is that what we're seeing with their defensive game, or is this just like they are so uber focused on playing defense now because they know how, you know, glaring of an issue it's been in the past, that that's why they're having the results that they're having early on?
I think it's a couple, you know, maybe probably a mixture of both those things. I think there's definitely been, you know, a massive, you know, focus, if you will, on the defensive side of the game. But you're right, the team is also constructed differently. TJ Brody, you know, he brings offensive upside, but they really, when everyone's healthy, they have a true top four with Riley, you know, himself, Muzzin, and Brody. So it's a team that definitely committed to defensive hockey or being better defensively, I should say. But I think that they're just constructed better. I mean, we saw last year, like Tyson Barrie just didn't work here. They tried to trade him because then they lost him for nothing. The roster is definitely constructed better. You see more commitment from Matthews and Marner defensively. I've noticed. You know, Matthews is good at being defensive when he needs to be, because he's learned and he knows that, you know, when it's easier to get the puck back and you don't have to waste energy chasing guys. So the commitment on that end, I think, has been one of the other big factors. But yeah, roster construction for sure, and just across the board commitment has been the difference, at least especially in the last three games.
I have to say, I was not totally sure what to expect. I know Justin Hall played pretty well down the stretch last year and even in the playoffs with Muzzin before he got hurt against Columbus. But I've been pleasantly surprised with how strong he's looked, like you said, in the top four. I thought he had a lot of good moments last night, playing a lot against McDavid and taking his lumps as well against Dreisaitl. Is there just now a fair amount of confidence and just kind of a set and forget it when it comes to Justin Hall being entrenched in the top four there with Muzzin?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he's definitely shown a lot. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that he was healthy scratched, what, like 72 or 74 games in that one season a couple years back. So he's definitely built on his game, built on his reputation, looks more confident. Muzzin today was talking about his game, but also what they can improve. So they know that they have to get better. Jake Muzzin was talking about how that pair in particular needs to move the puck quicker, because that helps them out defensively, because then they won't have to defend as much if they get the puck up to the forward. So, you know, retrievals are another thing they're working on. But, Hall's a guy that I don't think anybody a couple years ago envisioned in this role, and good for him to grab the chance that he was given and really run with it.
Josh, appreciate the time tonight, man. Really, really good stuff. Enjoy the game tomorrow. We'll do this again soon.
All right. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Josh Clipperton, national hockey writer for the Canadian Press. I think we lost you there, Mark.
No, I'm here. Like, I had it on mute. What a dummy.
Oh, you had it on mute. Okay.
I wasn't sure.
Yeah, of course.
No. No.
I'm still figuring out the mute button, like whether I never remember with these headsets if the mute button is pushed down if we're muted or not. I think if it's pushed in, you're good. If it's popped out, you're muted.
Yes, exactly. And I always, after I finish asking a question, I will always mute, because I have a dog that could start barking anytime. My cat could come downstairs and cause a ruckus with the dog. So I try and maintain that level of professionalism, but it's not very professional when you don't hit the unmute button. And then we have like the problem that we just had. But wanted to dive in a little bit deeper on this Leaf team. And, you know, I said it last night, and I said it only half tongue in cheek, but this team was way more exciting when they didn't care about playing defense. It just seems like they are so focused on playing good defensive hockey that they have really sacrificed on the offensive end. It's almost like all of their energy is going towards, you know, making sure that they keep the puck out of their net. And I'm fine with that. But the way I kind of look at it is, I want them to play like that in the playoffs, because in the regular season, that hasn't been an issue. They get by. They play enough teams that they beat, and they're better talent-wise than every team in this division right now. So they can go out and have fun and score goals and you know, play pond hockey. They should, as professionals, be able to flip that switch and play like they are now defensively in the playoffs. So it has been a little bit unexpected, I guess you could say, from this Leaf team so far.
So I see where you're coming from, and if it was a more, I guess, seasoned team, I would probably be more on board with it. But I just feel like, you know, we've seen what the end result has been for the way that the Maple Leafs have played the last, you know, 3, 4, 5 years. When they play that kind of fire wagon, house on fire situation in the regular season, they'll win a lot of games. They'll score a lot of goals. They'll give up a lot of goals. They'll give up a lot of chances. And their talent is good enough at the top end of their roster that they can still find a way to get it done and find a way to win a lot of games. But when it comes to the playoffs and you run into a team like we saw with Columbus last year and obviously Boston, I think for the most part in their meetings, maybe there was the last time they met, you could argue Toronto was the better team and should have won that series. But there's just, you know, those teams can take away from the Maple Leafs and the Maple Leafs maybe can't take away quite as much. And there's just not that ability to find another way to get to where they want to go and accomplish what they want to accomplish on the ice. And, you know, having success getting to the middle of the ice, they're on the perimeter too much and they're just, they become easy to defend and they don't have a lot of other bullets in the chamber. They just kind of keep firing the same ones and hoping that they'll land a little bit differently. And they haven't. So if you continue that sort of style in the regular season and then you just want to try and all of a sudden let the puzzle pieces fit in a little bit differently, you're trying to build a slightly different puzzle in the playoffs. I just feel like the puzzle pieces, if they're not, if you don't have it adjusted the right way in the regular season, you're not, I think, all of a sudden going to be able to find that different, slightly different, or just very different, however you want to look at it, just that way that you maybe need to play a little bit more in the playoffs against a tougher team, a tighter checking team, a better all-around defensive team than you might see in the regular season. I just feel like if the Leafs continue to play that just carefree style where they're just up and down the ice and turning the puck over and there's lots of chances both ways, I just feel like we might be in store for more of the same when the playoffs roll around.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I pray for chaos. Like, that's my thing. I absolutely love chaos, and that's what the Leafs bring. But the one thing, and maybe this is, in talking with Anthony Stewart about this, this is a systemic thing that they're doing, but it is absolutely driving me nuts. I don't know if you've noticed, but their inability to make any sort of plays on odd man rushes has been absolutely mind-numbing. They go in and then they hold on to the puck for eons, and then the defenseman slides on his stomach, blocks the pass, and then they're at the goal line and they haven't made a play yet. That's them holding on to the puck, and I get that. Like, I saw William Nylander turn a one-on-one into a one-on-four real quick a couple of nights ago, or a few nights ago against Winnipeg. And that kind of stuff, I get it, and maybe it's just a rust thing when it, for these guys, because they haven't played in, or they played 5 games in 10 months. But just the level of execution right now is a little bit off. And maybe that's all it is when it comes to this team just breaking out offensively. But it's at least mildly concerning for me, because on two-on-ones, they're not even getting shots. Forget scoring chances. Forget even, you know, scoring a goal. They're not even getting a shot towards the net a lot of times. And it is really, really hard to watch.
That's, I think, you know, maybe it's been more noticeable. I definitely have noticed it. You know, it seems like you're passing up a good chance to find a better chance that may never come. And a lot of times it seems like maybe early on this year, that better chance hasn't always come and you're giving something up for, like I said, something that might not be there. But yeah, it's been something. I don't know what it is. It's just like these skilled players maybe want to get as clean of a look as they possibly can. And, you know, even though you have one there, I definitely have noticed it. There's just been, you know, I thought last night was just really puzzling in terms of just being on the perimeter so much. Like, Edmonton is a bad defensive team, and you could maybe make the argument that they're a bad team, but period, like top to bottom outside of a couple of exceptions, and we know who the exceptions are. They've got some great top-end skill, but you look at the blue line, you look at their bottom six, you look at their goaltending, it's not particularly good. So to muster mid-ish 20 shots and one goal and not a ton of really, really good chances was really puzzling to me. And like we were talking about with Josh, it's just been a strange kind of hybrid balance right now where they're caught in between. I understand they know that they're identifying that they have to play a certain way and they would like to be responsible a little bit more. But the hallmark of a good team is trying to find that that medium where you can be really good offensively and also be responsible enough defensively so you're not getting caved and you're not giving up all the chances that we've seen from the Leafs the last couple of years. We saw it in Tampa Bay. They made the adjustments last year. They tinkered with their roster. They brought in the right kind of pieces. Jury is still very much out. Verdict is still very much out on the Maple Leafs, whether that's the case. But they just have to continue being able to find that happy medium where they can showcase, spotlight their skill while also not just hemorrhaging chances defensively.
Yeah, it's just, you know, being a better team all around. That's we've been preaching this for a long time with this group. God, they haven't won a playoff game in or a playoff series in, you know, what feels like 100 years. But, you know, let's hope that this thing improves itself. I think they're going to move in the right direction. The offense will come. I think the defensive part of the game has always been the tough one for them. So now that they've got that seemingly down pat, I think we can move forward here and have some good results. Apparently, the Tokyo Games are in jeopardy. Wow, you don't say. I'm absolutely stunned by this. We'll talk more about it after the break coming up here on Sportsnet Tonight. This is Sportsnet Tonight on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, and the Sportsnet Radio Network. The wonderful sounds of the Olympics. But we won't be hearing or seeing any of those this year. This is Sportsnet Tonight. I'm Matt Marchese and my co-host Josh Goldberg alongside me. And Josh, I feel like this was the inevitable here, but, you know, officials in Tokyo have kind of been a little hush-hush over the last few months, but now the stories are starting to flow out that it looks like we are not going to have the what was supposed to be the 2020 Summer Games in Tokyo in 2021. And now it looks like they're preparing for 2022. Just wide brush thoughts first on this. Again, I don't think that anybody thought that this was going to happen the way that the world is going right now.
No, definitely not. I understand, you know, you're probably looking to see if there was some possible way you could maybe get this thing done without fans, but I just feel like, you know, if even in that situation, you're bringing athletes from literally not every single country, I don't think, but damn near every single country on the globe. It is truly a global spectacle. And, you know, as we've seen, certain countries may have a better grasp on this virus than others. And short of big time improvements in vaccination, and that seems unlikely in the next, you know, six-ish months. It was not realistic to have this thing pulled off safely. You know, you would have had a really serious testing situation and maybe you could have pulled that off, but just so much work. And, you know, especially without the ability to have your loving, adoring fans watching it, which is a big part of the spirit of the thing when it comes to the Olympics, just too many things needed to happen to get this thing done and in any way, shape, or form. And I think they just finally reached the conclusion that, you know, this is just not something that is feasible or sensible. So let's start thinking about how we can pull the plug on this and turn our eyes, at least if you're Tokyo, to the next available Olympics, which is, I think, 2032. And you would think that they'll get that. I would hope, right? This was beyond any circumstances they could have foreseen. You would hope that the IOC would just kind of award the 2032 to them as a makeup to this one just getting pulled from under them.
Well, the IOC is not known to be, you know, a criminal organization or anything, so they might make them pay twice. But at the end of the day, this is a business. And, you know, as much as we want to believe that they would like to put the safety of the athletes ahead of all else, at the end of the day, they weren't going to make money on this. And they don't make it anyway, but they weren't going to make back any money. Because I would be very curious to know how much of this is based on, like, the sponsorship thing is absolutely huge. And if you don't have a lot of people there, then, you know, you don't have revenue from people coming in and out of the city. There's a lot that goes into that. And I wonder how many sponsors, because of that fact, would have pulled out from the games. Like, I understand that you get a lot of eyeballs on you on TV, but, you know, I wonder how much that plays into effect here. There's a lot to that you could talk about the IOC. At the end of the day, it's a business, and they're going to look for how can we make the most money possible. And this just wasn't it. And Tokyo is right to pull out. It just wasn't, like you said, it just wasn't going to work logistically, bringing in all these people from countries where, you know, in fairness, Josh, we don't know a lot about. But not only that, some of the stuff that we are getting out of certain countries may not be factual. So
for sure,
there's too many things to unravel here. But the latest is that the Tokyo games that were supposed to happen last year aren't going to be happening this year, much to no one's surprise. What may have been a surprise is the Blue Jays signing George Springer. And it came as a shock to me, certainly, because it looked like the Mets were all over that deal and it was just going to be another guy that slipped through their fingers. But this is the big fish. This is the guy that they wanted. This is the guy that they targeted, and they got it done. We're going to talk to Nick Ashburn from Sportsnet and Yahoo coming up after the break. We're going to talk about George Springer. They just finalized their deal with Kirby Yates. They also finalized a deal with Tyler Chatwood. It's a pretty interesting offseason, and they might not be done. This is Sportsnet tonight on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, and the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Game night is the best night, and we're not talking rummy, canasta, or baccarat. All your games in one place. This is Sportsnet tonight on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Back to Sportsnet tonight on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, and the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm your host, Matt Marchese. Alongside me tonight, my co-host, Josh Goldberg. You can follow us on Twitter at MattSN590 and at JGoldberg12. Well, as you already know, the big fish has landed, and well, sort of landed, in Toronto, and that's George Springer, one of the prized free agents of this offseason in Major League Baseball, and I can't believe that I'm still in shock that it actually happened, because it just felt like the Jays were falling short on seemingly everybody that they were interested in. But to talk about that, along with some other Jays news, joining us on the line, Nick Ashburn, he's a contributor for Sportsnet and Yahoo Sports. Nick, how are you doing tonight?
Good. Thanks for having me on.
Appreciate you doing this. And, you know, just first blush at this Springer thing, were you expecting the Jays to – I think we're all expecting them to be aggressive, but did you expect them to be this aggressive and actually, you know, get this deal done with Springer with the Mets kind of breathing down their neck?
I mean, you had the feeling that they were going to land somebody big. They really talked going into the offseason about making this kind of elite upgrade. But, you know, there's a difference between seeing the logic behind something and seeing it happen. And nothing like this has ever really happened before in franchise history. They've never landed, you know, the free agent. You could argue him and Real Muto, who's the best position player free agent. But I would say he's probably number one. So the Blue Jays have never done this as a franchise, so no matter how much it makes sense on the win curve, no matter how much, you know, Shapiro and Atkins said they're going to make a move like this, like you said, it's kind of hard to believe it was going to happen until that news dropped.
So I guess, you know, a lot of people will look at a six-year contract for a 31-year-old outfielder and just say, well, you know, 3 years will be great, but what will year 4, 5, and 6 look like for George Springer? Is he the type of player who maybe will be able to buck some of the aging trends and be able to age a little bit more gracefully as he gets to 34, 35, and if he does have to eventually move to a corner outfield spot?
Yeah, I'm fairly optimistic about that. I think he's a guy whose athleticism has held up really well. He played more center field last year on the wrong side of 30 than he had in recent years, and he looked pretty good doing it. He's a guy who over the last couple of years has been sort of a top 10 hitter in baseball. So even if he declines a fair amount, I think there's a lot of wiggle room there for him to be a pretty good corner outfielder let's say, in years 4 or 5 of this contract. Now, by the time year 6 rolls around, is he going to be worth what he's being paid? Probably not. That's the way these contracts work. You got to get that value out of them early, and then the last couple of years maybe don't look as good, but you hope that, you know, you've had the playoff success you wanted to with them, you've had those monster years out of them, and then it's okay to have the 6 year of the contract maybe not look like the best thing you've ever signed.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that, because I feel like the one bit of advice that I would give to Jays fans is, A, you shouldn't care because it's not your money, and B, worry about the next 3 or 4 years, because there is a very intriguing window going forward here with this group of bats that they have, and hopefully they can add some starting pitching. Like, to look into year 6 when the contract hasn't even started, it seems kind of ridiculous to me right now.
Yeah, I think that, you know, let's say Springer plays center field for the first 3 years of the contract, just for sake of argument, and he's a top, even if he's not top 10, he's a top 30 hitter during that time. You're getting incredible value on that. A guy who is playing a really, you know, at least a solid or okay center field and hitting as one of the better hitters in the league. You know, the $25 million you're paying him is nothing. It's peanuts. So by the end of that deal, even if he has almost no positive value in that, you know, that 6 year that you can kind of throw out the window, he'll probably have paid that forward. I think it's those years 4 and 5 where things might end up looking a little bit dicey, but yeah, now is not the time to be preoccupied with that.
So I'm curious if you think that this type of move and this type of player coming to Toronto, I understand they gave him a lot of money and they maybe went to a 6 year when maybe no other team would, perhaps the Mets, but they went above and beyond. Is this finally maybe the end of the Jays can't lure a free agent to Toronto because it's Toronto? Do you think that Ryu last year and then doubling down and stacking Springer on top of that will, you know, especially in addition to this young core, be able to say to free agents, you know what, Toronto's worth it, and I want to come play as a Blue Jay?
I think it definitely makes a statement. When you look at their, you know, their prior top free agent contracts, you know, it's Russell Martin, he's a Canadian guy, it's Ryu, who's from Korea. I think it makes a difference that it's an American player who had the option to play closer to home. And like you said, they offered one more year than other people did, and they offered more money and whatnot. But we have not seen that premium American free agent land in Toronto, make that choice. And I think it definitely opens some eyes about how serious this franchise is to spend. And I think if other free agents see, you know, Springer having success in Toronto, seeming to enjoy Toronto, that's going to be something that affects their decision-making going forward.
Nick Ashburn is our guest here on Sportsnet tonight, and you make a great point about the American player coming in, because that's seemingly been, and this isn't just a Toronto Blue Jays problem, it's a Toronto Raptor problem as well. Whenever they wanted to bring in talent, it usually had to be by trade. And having said that, you know, how much does that matter this offseason, where they could lure a big free agent and now they can use some of those other pieces that they have that they may have had to trade for an outfielder? They can now use it to acquire some starting pitching.
Yeah, I mean, they had a full outfield in theory prior to signing this. I know that Grichuk is no one's idea of an ideal center fielder, but they could have gone into 2021 without adding an outfielder. And now it does seem like they have an excess guy. And I know that there's a lot of lineups people are putting out now that they're thinking for the Blue Jays for this season, and they include all four of those outfielders, and one of them is a DH. But, you know, those lineups include Vladdy at third base, which I think is no sure thing, regardless of all the great work he's done on his body in the offseason. So it would not be a stretch to see them moving. You know, I know the fans want it to be Grichuk, right? But there's not much trade value in Grichuk. So Gurriel Jr. is a really good trade piece and someone that you could land a pretty good starting pitcher with him as the focal point of that deal. So it wouldn't surprise me at all to see them use this move to make another move to shore up the pitching rotation, which is really, you know, the biggest problem with the team heading into the offseason.
I agree with you. I feel like you have to improve the rotation, whether it's a couple of pieces or, you know, an ace even ahead of a Ryu, whether it's Bauer or trade. But do you think that the Springer move even ratchets up the pressure to get that done more so?
I think there's an increased urgency when you bring in someone like Springer. You know, he is 31. I think that his decline will probably be relatively gradual. But when you have someone like Springer at 31 and Ryu is your best pitcher, he's in his 30s as well, you don't have that much time to wait around because these guys, you know, you might think their decline's not going to be that bad, but they're probably not going to get better either. So you've got players who are really at the apex of their power. So it seems like a waste to have these players you're paying a ton of money for who are probably not going to be getting better in the future years and then kind of sit on your hands when there's a serious hole in your team, and that's the rotation. And past Ryu, they really struggled last season to get quality innings, and based on the guys they've got lined up this year, there isn't that much reason to believe they'll be much better unless they make some additions.
Nick, just wanted to get your thoughts on the Kirby Yates deal. He's just 1 year removed from a 41 save season. He had a 1.19 ERA. His WHIP was under one, and had 15 strikeouts per nine innings. I understand that last year was not, you know, what he wanted, but he did have, you know, bone chips removed from his elbow. Like, there's a lot going on there. But is this deal low risk enough that just the positives will so much, so far outweigh the negatives?
Yeah, it's a bit of a shame the Kirby Yates deal hasn't gotten as much shine. It's obviously Springer's going to overshadow what's going on with a bullpen piece like that. But I think the Yates is a really, really strong deal. I know that some people look at his last year, and, you know, to be frank, it was a lost year. He pitched 4.1 innings. Yeah, he got blown up in a couple of outings, but to say that his stuff is gone is ridiculous. This is a guy who was probably the best reliever in baseball in 2019. He's got an unbelievable splitter. He's got a pretty good fastball as well, and I'd be surprised if he isn't a difference maker in this bullpen, and that's a deal that looks like it could be a real bargain. And the injury, too, the bone chips, it's not like, you know, he blew out his shoulder or something that you really worry about recurring. You'd like to think that that's an issue that came up and got resolved and shouldn't play too much into how he performs in 2021.
So I love the signing totally, and he's probably, you would think, the clubhouse favorite to get saves. But do you like the idea of also just really going after it and bringing in somebody like Brad Hand? Because the old adage is you can never have too many good arms in the bullpen.
Hand is a really interesting case. I think that, you know, it's easy to say it depends on what the price is, because any player can be a good or bad deal depending on the price. There are some concerns with Hand. His velocity fell off last year. He was still able to be effective, mainly due to his really nasty slider. But he's a guy who's probably going to demand a multi-year contract, you would think, even though he was he passed through waivers on a one-year deal. So he's someone I actually have a few more reservations about than I do about Yates. But on the other hand, getting a left-hander in the bullpen, his experience, his pedigree, it would be hard to be against a move like that. But he comes with a couple more red flags than you might think, considering the numbers he's put up.
Nick, I would like to see them go out and get, like, it would be great to see them go out and get Trevor Bauer. I'm sure that would be on the wish list for a lot of Blue Jays fans. But how much of this season do you think will hinge on Nate Pearson becoming what everybody expects that he will become as a real solid top of the rotation starter and an ace that many are projecting?
I mean, if Nate Pearson can become that guy, that changes the entire complexion of the team, you know. And in a situation where Nate Pearson is an ace and then you've got Ryu right there, then you're starting to cobble together a decent rotation, especially if you add another player. I think the problem with Pearson is that we've seen quite a few injuries. We haven't seen that performance at the MLB level. There's reasons to be super optimistic, but he's got this enormous range of outcomes, and that's kind of the reason why pursuing more of that help is super important, because Pearson is a guy you can dream on, but right now he's not a guy you can rely on yet.
Yeah, I'm curious to get your thoughts. I was reading a blurb, you know, the Fangraphs had the top prospects in the Blue Jays system and a write-up on, I think, almost 40. And there was something in there that, you know, maybe Nate Pearson could end up being an Aroldis Chapman if he, in a shortened season or a season where he can't dial up his workload, maybe he's just better in the bullpen and you keep him there. I have to assume that that is something that the Blue Jays would look to avoid at all costs, right?
Yeah, I think if you were looking at a different team that was loaded in the rotation and, you know, creating a super bullpen, kind of like the, you know, the Kansas City Royals team that won the World Series, that was sort of the bridge you had to cross to become a true World Series contender. there's a scenario we've seen with guys like David Price early in his career becoming a bullpen weapon. But this team needs starters, and Pearson has that ability to be a top-end starter. And even though we don't know whether that's going to happen or not, it would really behoove the Blue Jays to find out. And I think that they're going to give him some time to be that guy because they need a starter far more than they need a reliever. And they always know that that's going to be an option. If things don't work out 1 or 2 years from now, he continues to have injury problems, he can't hold out under a workload. In 2 years, he could be a really good reliever. I think, you know, we saw him against Tampa Bay in the playoffs, even that one outing. We know what he can do in the bullpen, so there's no need to force that path for him.
Nick, it's certainly going to be an interesting rest of the offseason. I think Jays fans are hoping that this front office is not done yet, but we'll watch, and hopefully we have some news to chat about soon. Thanks again for doing this tonight. Appreciate it.
Appreciate you having me on.
Nick Ashburn from Sportsnet and Yahoo Sports. And Josh, you know, the Springer thing has kind of elevated expectations for this roster. And seemingly, I think you look at this team, and just like you would look at any other team, and say, okay, you can kind of cobble together a decent bullpen. We saw them do it last year with a bunch of guys that nobody expected much out of, and they did that with their best, arguably their best reliever on the shelf for the majority of the season, in Giles. So when you look at this off season, I don't think we expect them to be done, but if they are in fact done, is getting George Springer enough, along with, you know, adding some pieces here and there, to say that this was a successful offseason for this front office?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, anytime you get your top target, I guess it depends on what that top target is. Like, if it is actually one of the preeminent premier players on the free agent market, it's a success. And you bake in the fact that you handed out the biggest contract in franchise history. It was a player who, I'm not sure how sought after he was. You know, the Mets were interested. We didn't really hear a ton else. So maybe there weren't that many suitors, but he had a market, and you had to convince him to come here, and you probably had to get out of your comfort zone a little bit with that 6 year. And I still think $25 million is a really good number for him, whether it was a 5 or a 6 year deal. I think there's plenty of value to be had on that contract. And the need was just so glaring in center field that you filled it with one of the, I don't know, maybe 20 best position players in baseball. That's a home run any way you slice it. So anything else that ends up coming in, and, you know, Kirby Yates, that's a nice pickup. Maybe Tyler Chatwood turns into something in the bullpen. His strikeout numbers were good in a shortened season this year. I think there is something there if they can work everything out mechanically. He's got good spin rate. I think he could be effective. And then there's still going to be moves. Maybe they bring back Taijuan Walker. Maybe they go out, and I don't think Bauer's coming here, but you never know. You can't rule it out. And, you know, whether it's Walker, Odorizzi, or somebody like that, Tanaka has been linked, according to a report out of Japan. Maybe that's a possibility. Maybe you do go out and get Brad Hand. Shai was saying today on, I believe, Writer's Block, that Didi Gregorius is a possibility to play third base, because I don't think Vladdy, I don't want Vladdy, I don't know about you, I don't want him opening the season as the everyday third baseman. Certainly not. Like, if he maybe gets the odd game at third base, I could live with that. But for me, at this point, I think we got to commit to seeing him at first base. I think the Blue Jays got to commit to it. They opened the Pandora's box this past season. I think you got to give it a real look this year. And I think that's probably, not probably, that is his home in the future. So let's just get it going this year. But anything else that comes in, falls around Springer, yeah, it's gravy. And if anything, this front office has just continued to earn the faith, trust, and goodwill of this fan base, that they're going to get the job done, and they're going to bring in players to, I guess, continue to elevate both the floor and obviously the ceiling of this ball club. Because right now I look at them as, you know, an 85 to 90 win team as they're currently constructed with the move to bring in Springer. If they fortify the rotation, maybe they bring in Brad Hand, they bring in a third baseman, we could be talking about a 95 win team. Regardless of the playoff format, they're probably making the playoffs, and more likely than that, they're probably pushing certainly Tampa Bay and the Yankees in the division. So it's hard to really be anything other than just overjoyed right now if you're a Blue Jays fan.
Yeah, and I think the cynic would say, well, they didn't address their biggest need, and that is the rotation. Now, having said that, there's been some talk about maybe they have some interest in a guy like Chris Bryant, who's in the last year of his deal. And Dan Shulman, I believe, was on Good Show earlier, and he said, you know, to acquire a guy like that who's going into a contract year, who could put up like a monstrous season, is the perfect recipe for success. So if you had a star pitcher who is on a one-year deal that you needed to trade for, or you had Chris Bryant that you were going to trade for, which guy would you prefer at this point? So maybe it's probably a number two starter would be the same value as Bryant, would be my guess. So which of the two do you want?
I'd probably take the starter. I'm taking the starter, to be honest.
Yeah, and I think that's the right way to go. And I really do believe that the success of Nate Pearson will, I don't want to say make or break this team, but it could be the difference from them being a very good playoff team to being an elite playoff team if they can get another starter to go along with himself and Ryu.
Oh, I like, as far as Bryant goes, I'm more bullish probably than maybe not most, but a lot of people. Like, he had a terrible year this past year. He's dealt with injuries, shoulder stuff in the past. It's maybe sapped some of his ability to drive the ball, but I still think he's maybe not quite the elite player he was when he was winning the MVP and helping the Cubs win the World Series, but he's still a well above average offensive player. So he would be great, but he's probably a one-year rental. I know that it's fair right now to be more optimistic about the Blue Jays' ability to not just lure free agents, but maybe to re-sign a player like that when you have Springer on the board and you're building something that appears to be pretty special. But I just, Chris Bryant strikes me as the type of player who would be more likely to go to a glitzy, big market American city. And it doesn't seem super likely that he would want to be a Blue Jay long term, but I can't say that with 100% of a definitive answer. Maybe you bring him in here and wow him and he ends up signing a deal. But I just feel like there are good third base options out there. And if you were going to go out there on the free agent market, at least, and if you're going to go out there and make a trade and part with some of your, you know, finer prospects to get somebody with some control and somebody who's a little bit younger with upside in the rotation, that to me just makes a little bit more sense. You know, if we're talking Luis Castillo from Cincinnati, we're talking Marquez from Cincinnati. If you wanted to package Kyle Hendricks and Chris Bryant, okay, maybe then we're talking, then I'm talking about involving Lourdes Gurriel Jr. and maybe some a legit prospect as well. But just Bryant, I don't know how much what the price is going to be, and if it was low, I'd probably do it. But if we're talking about similar price tags for Bryant and a starter with control, which I think is unrealistic because Bryant is at the end of his deal, and you know, just generally, it doesn't sound like his value is that high. I just feel like the starter with term and upside would just be such a boost to what the Blue Jays have right now.
Yeah, I am totally, totally on board with that. Listen, it's going to be an exciting season, and I'm really looking forward to see the fireworks that this team can create in the AL East. A team that has been creating fireworks all season long is playing in the AFC Championship game on Sunday. And no, I am not talking about the Kansas City Chiefs. I'm talking about my Buffalo Bills. They got a tough matchup this weekend, and we're going to break it down with Greg Thompson from the Cover One Buffalo podcast coming up on Sportsnet tonight, right here on Sportsnet 590, The Fan and the Sportsnet Radio Network.
The Bills make me wanna shout. Kick your heels up and shout. Throw your hands up and shout. Throw your head back and shout. Come on now, the Bills are making it happen now. Stand up now, come on and shout. Yeah.
Say you will.
Shout it right now,
the
baby.
Wonderful sounds of the Bills make me want to shout. And they've been making me want to shout all season long. And that will continue this Sunday in the AFC Championship game against the Kansas City Chiefs. I can't believe that I just said that, but here we are. Joining us on the line right now, is someone who covers the Bills, who knows them very well, does great breakdowns on them, and that is Greg Thompson, host of the Cover One Buffalo podcast. Greg, how are you doing tonight?
Not too bad. Glad to be on with you guys. It's exciting to still be talking about the season. I'm so used to being shifted into draft mode by now and doing draft breakdowns. This is a new experience for me. I think I'd get used to it.
Yeah, no kidding. I would say, who cares about the draft at this point, because it's going to be a late first round pick either way. But, you know, just from a fan perspective, you know, as you know, I'm a huge Bills fan myself. It's gone back since I was a little kid. My dad was a fan, all that stuff. And just the, like, I'm getting chills just thinking about this, but to see them back in the AFC Championship for the first time in basically forever in sports terms, what is this feeling like? Have you gotten that nervous energy? Like, I started to get mine today. When did the nervous energy start to set in for you, or has it at all?
For sure. It really has. So a couple weird oddities. It's been 27 years since the Bills were in the AFC Championship game, and in that year, it was the Bills beating Joe Montana's led Kansas City Chiefs. And 27 years before that was the Bills and the Chiefs in the AFL Championship right before it moved over to the Super Bowl. So very oddly, every 27 years, the Bills and the Chiefs meet for the championship of the AFC. It's certainly getting ramped up to that point. So we've done our preview show on Cover One and gone through all the analysis and the video breakdown. We've done tendencies on, you know, what things maybe were logical in the initial game plan, but, you know, weren't executed well. Can those maintain? But, you know, I think we're a better team now than the Bills were in week six. But do they need to change some of that up just because now Reed and Spagnuolo have seen those things? And I feel uncomfortable with how comfortable I am. I don't like the fact that I feel kind of good about this game. That feels wrong, and that's making me anxious.
So I guess what is the one or maybe two things about this matchup that makes you feel most optimistic that the Bills could not only keep this ball game close but go into Arrowhead and pull this thing out and win this ball game?
I think, you know, when people talk about the different segments that match up, they're right to say that the explosiveness and the high ceiling of the Chiefs offense is probably still a little bit higher than the Bills. When they turn it on and are hitting on all cylinders, there's nobody like them. And Patrick Mahomes has three straight AFC Championship games and a Super Bowl experience that Josh Allen just doesn't have. Like, he can't create that experience in those moments. And that's fine. I think that that's accurate. I think that their capacity on offense is slightly higher than the Bills. I think the Bills are close, but the Chiefs are higher. I think people are underestimating how much better the Bills' defense and special teams is than the Chiefs. And I think the gap of how much better the Bills' defense is and special teams is more than what the gap is between the Chiefs' offense and the Bills' offense. And in a game like this, no one's shutting down either offense. This isn't going to be some 13-10 knockdown dragout. This is going to be a shootout. People are going to score points. I think the Bills have a better chance of having that big sack, that big turnover, that big play than what the Chiefs do. And I think that could be what it comes down to.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that. Like, I looked at the breakdown between the two teams, like the tail of the tape type thing, and how close they were on both the offensive and defensive side of the ball was alarmingly close. Like, I couldn't believe it. But, you know, you mentioned the last time these two teams played each other. And for those that don't remember, it was week six. The Bills lost by 9 points. But the game itself was actually a lot closer score-wise until late in the game when I believe there was the Bills turned the ball over. But the Bills didn't have Matt Milano. Dawson Knox didn't play. Harrison Phillips didn't play. Taron Johnson was benched. Tremaine Edmonds was really hurt. The Bills are healthier. The argument you can make here is that the Bills were the better team down the stretch than KC was. KC only won two games by more than 6 points since week six. The Bills have won eight by more than 6 points. And I'm not saying that this is, lockstep. The Bills are going to win this one and they're going to win it going away. But for those that think that the Bills aren't of the same level as Kansas City on both sides of the ball. I think that's the wrong way to look at it.
Yeah, 100%. You're spot on. And the experience, they're the defending Super Bowl champions. There's nothing wrong with seeing them as the favorite. They deserve to be favored at home. But there's very much a reason this is only a 3-point game. Like, this is not some David versus Goliath underdog. These are the two best teams in the AFC, but probably two of the three best teams in the NFL, and they deserve to be right there, neck and neck. And that, honestly, if you look at any of the, we do a fair amount of work with DVOA and how it kind of sanitizes some of the efficiency versus the game script versus the opponent. And it really kind of helps boil down how good your offense, defense, special teams are. They also provide a number that's weighted DVOA that shows, well, how good are you lately and how good are you over the second half of the season? Over the second half of the season, the Bills are actually a materially better team, like a significant amount better than what the Chiefs are. And, some of that, maybe there's some noise in there. There's some weird games that the Chiefs barely beat the Dolphins and barely beat the Falcons and, barely beat the Browns, and some weird numbers in there. But they're certainly not clicking on all cylinders right now. And the Bills have played better teams in the playoffs. They played a higher degree of opponent. And the way all those things shake out, you're right. No one should be making the case that the Bills are about to blow out the Chiefs. That's silly. What it is saying is this isn't something where they need to hope for everything to break right for them to have any chance. They have a 50-50 shot at winning this game.
If you had to pick the focal point of the defense, if you're going up against Kansas City, is it Tyreek Hill or is it Travis Kelce?
So this is a tough one, and we've done a fair amount of work on it. That you look at that last game, Tyreek Hill had 3 catches for 20 yards. He was very clearly the focus of the defense. Now, Kelce had 6 for 67 and 2 touchdowns. The 6 for 67 isn't bad, but when you talk about how much rushing yardage they had, that wasn't critical. That game didn't have Matt Milano. That game had the early season A.J. Klein, which there wasn't much worse than early season A.J. Klein. You mentioned all the other guys who were either dinged, Trey White playing limited, Taron Johnson benched, all those different pieces. I think they're in a better shape to try to take a stab at a similar game plan with a lot of bracket coverage on Tyreek Hill, not straight out doubling, but multiple guys looking at him every single snap, and then hoping that the combination of Taron Johnson and Matt Milano are better against Travis Kelce than what AJ Klein. And at the time, I actually think we were giving a couple of the practice squad guys a run at it that you saw at the nickel. So, I think that's the hope, is that they can execute better. And I do think that, the Chiefs didn't come into that game planning to run the ball. The Bills taunted them into it with 5-man boxes, and they were putting everyone out into coverage. The hope is now the D-line's playing better, the linebackers are playing better. They can tempt them with that same thing and hopefully now rally and tackle better than they did.
Greg Thompson is our guest on Sportsnet tonight, host of the Cover One Buffalo podcast. It's funny that we've gone this long and we have barely talked about the MVP of this Bills team, and that's Josh Allen. And I think he put all doubters to bed with, well, we don't know what we're going to get with Josh Allen in the playoffs. And then he went out and he absolutely lit up the Indianapolis Colts, who, by the way, are a pretty good defense. We saw him struggle a little bit last week against the Ravens, although they moved the ball okay. It wasn't, they weren't awful, but they certainly weren't what we've seen. And the Ravens completely changed their defensive game plan, and they sat back and tried to have Josh Allen beat them instead of, blitzing him like crazy like we saw last year in the matchup between the two teams. Firstly, what is your impression of Allen in the playoffs been? And secondly, how do you think that the Chiefs will approach this game defensively?
So the first thing is, it's pretty cool that Josh Allen is so scary that the blitz happiest team in the NFL completely stopped doing it, because he's number one in the NFL against the blitz in yards and pass, or yards and passing touchdowns. So that's pretty cool to see that Josh Allen is now of that caliber, where Wink Martindale is the blitz happiest defensive coordinator in the NFL, and he stopped because he was afraid of what Josh Allen could do against the blitz. from talking to some folks who were in the stadium at the game, all of the talk that you heard from Al Michaels and Chris Collinsworth about the wind was very real. You saw the shots of the goal, not even the flags, the literal goal posts being moved back and forth. I was a little disappointed that Josh initially experienced that and saw it, and he kept going for those kill shots, which, I mean, don't get me wrong, it's you know, two-faced to me to complain about it, and then I celebrate when he hits those ridiculous deep shots. But at some point, when you saw how strong the wind was, I would have loved to have seen him be a little more comfortable going to the death by a thousand paper cuts. That's boring. It takes a lot of discipline. But I think that was maybe a little more effective, especially there was a handful of them that were on third and manageable that he took shots to the end zone that I would have loved to have seen a shot to just convert and move on. But the fact that that's what we're nitpicking, and that now Josh Allen, you know, I think that if you just ask most Bills fans, did Josh Allen have a bad game? Most would say, well, yeah, I mean, he had a great season, but that was a pretty bad game. He completed 62% of his passes for over 200 yards and a touchdown with no turnovers. It's pretty great that that's his bad game now.
For sure. That's a really good point. And I know that he had one of his worst games of the year against Kansas City, like in terms of yards per attempt and completion percentage. But from what I remember, the weather was really bad and it was a weird week. And he's obviously, you know, continued to get better. So I don't know how much stock I put into that. The thing I'm curious if you put a lot of stock into is the run game and the fact that we saw, you know, with Zach Moss injured last week. I think the Bills carried the ball six or seven times, just a complete abandonment of the run. They didn't call a run play really until deep into the first half. Do you think that needs to change this week? Do they need to be more quote-unquote balanced, or are you all for spreading it out and throwing the ball again as much as possible?
So, I mean, the Bills are a passing team. Full stop, period, end of story. Yeah, they just are. And I think our desire for there to be an effective passing game doesn't necessarily correlate to the likelihood of all of a sudden being an effective running team. So I think that those first two drives in the second half, when you saw them come out there and have a nice mix, and mix doesn't mean 50-50. On the first scoring drive, they had four runs and seven passes. That's really good. I'd love to see that kind of mix where you're still talking 65-70% pass, but not literally. I think it was the 20th play of the game that they called their first called run. Technically, Allen had a scramble on the 18th play. The guy registered as a run, but that was a called pass. So it took till their 20th play to call a run play. Maybe that's a little heavy. That's a little tilted. But I don't want to change dramatically. The Bills are going to win or lose this game and or a championship based on their passing game. All of a sudden, trying to establish the run because it sounds like the right thing to do is not going to be the reason they win. So I hope they can do enough to keep them honest, mix a few in there to make the play action a little bit more effective, and to, you know, snag some. If they're giving us free 7 yards, take it. But beyond that, I'm not looking for this to turn into some 50-50 run-pass team because they're daring us to run. They're daring us to run because they're afraid of the pass.
Greg, today the Pro Football Writers Association named Brandon Bean Executive of the Year. I don't think that's a surprise to anyone. Maybe what could have been a little bit of a surprise, but none to a Bills fan, is that Brian Daboll was named the Assistant Coach of the Year. And, you know, I was completely stunned that he didn't get the Chargers job. I thought that that would be a great fit with Justin Herbert. And as much as you like to see guys, you know, progress in their careers, I was really hoping to get one more year with Brian Daboll with Josh Allen. Does this really feel like the Chargers loss is the Bills gain here for at least one more season?
Absolutely. I was flabbergasted. You mix in some of the other pieces, you know, high school teammates with their GM, Tom Telesco, what he did with a young, tall, athletic, strong-armed quarterback, you know, certainly seemed to fit what they're looking for with Justin Herbert. And, I can't imagine somebody being a hotter commodity or improving their stock as what Brian Daboll did. And Brandon Staley certainly seems like a good candidate, and maybe he's the Sean McDermott defensive culture builder that you want in that building. I don't know. Maybe he ends up being the right pick. I was flabbergasted. I'm certainly incredibly happy that now the reports are he's not interested. Obviously, we saw Western New York native Nick Sirianni. He's actually from my hometown down at Jamestown. That was just hired by the Philadelphia Eagles and a former Section 6 Western New York guy. And I don't think that there's any interest in Dable going to the Houston Texans. So it does seem pretty assured that we're going to get another year. And I actually am kind of quietly excited that I think that Sean McDermott and Brandon Bean, as diligent of planners as what they are, I would be shocked if we don't see some in-season succession planning with Ken Dorsey, that he now maybe has a passing game coordinator kind of role added or is involved in a little more of the specific game planning and play calling so that they're ready for a completely one-for-one in-house promotion. As you heard, you know, McDermott state that he feels Dable is very much deserving of this job. They're preparing for it. I think this almost kind of gave them a, hey, there's no more, you know, hollow hopes that you're going to keep the guy. We're going to lose him in 2022. Now they can actually get ready. So they seem like the diligent kind of guys that will leverage that and turn it into a opportunity to be even more prepared.
Well, I like how you mentioned Jamestown there, home of the Lucille Ball Desi Arnaz Museum. I played a couple of junior hockey games there, so I'm very familiar with the area. But, yeah, very shocking. Nice. And like I said, the Chargers loss is the Bills gain. So, Greg, thanks a lot for taking some time for us today. Really appreciate it. And hopefully I'll be able to say this again when I'm on with you. But go Bills.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, guys. Always a pleasure. Looking forward to a great game on Sunday and talk with you guys again.
Greg Thompson, host of the Cover One Buffalo podcast. And Josh, my fanboy comes on a lot when I talk about the Bills, but it really has been a whirlwind. And you look back at where this thing kind of started, and that was an Andy Dalton pass to Tyler Boyd against the Baltimore Ravens that kind of got this train rolling in the right direction. And then, you know, the addition of Josh Allen and his rise to becoming one of the, you know, you could argue top five quarterbacks in the NFL right now. It's been a wild ride as a Bills fan for a long, long time.
Oh, wild ride is definitely one way of putting it. I would say rough ride for a lot of it has maybe been more accurate. And hey, like for non-Bills fans, I'm sure there's been a lot of laughs at the expense of Bills fans, you know, for just some of the horrible years, the Doug Whaley years, the Buddy Nix years, Rex Ryan, Chan Gailey, you name it, Dick Duron. There were a lot of just tough Bills teams. And I'm not a Buffalo Bills fan. But I have plenty of Bills fans, friends, and I can't tell you how much joy and happiness it gives me to see Bills fans and friends who are Bills fans justifiably celebrating what is a great team and what appears to be a great team for a long time. You've suffered for a long time through that the teams were brutal. It was always being in that muddled, mushy middle where it was, you know, 5 to 7 or 8 wins, never bottoming out to really get that top tier pick, I guess, until Josh Allen, and just kind of struggling in that weird spot where you were never good enough, you were never bad enough for so many years. And then it finally came together. A lot of people thought the Allen pick was polarizing and, you know, he wasn't going to develop and he was a big arm and somebody who maybe just wasn't going to be a polished quarterback. And we already see that looks foolish, and it would be hard to envision him not putting at least one MVP mantle and at least one Super Bowl maybe as soon as this year on his mantle, but it's good to see. And I really do think that the NFL's better when a franchise and a fan base like the Buffalo Bills are relevant and the team is successful year in and year out.
Yeah, it's like you mentioned those lean years. God, I remember seeing, you know, we used to call him Dick Duron Skeletor, because that's kind of who he looks like. And there are some bad quarterbacks in there. And in reality, like, I love Doug Flutie as a Bill. I think he was hard done by with that whole Rob Johnson garbage. But let's face it, the Bills haven't had a quarterback like Josh Allen since Jim Kelly. Like, that's a long time. And then you look at some of the other franchises, like the Green Bay Packers went from Brett Favre to Aaron Rodgers. The New England Patriots had Tom Brady for whatever it was, 19 years or whatever that length of time was. I'm trying to forget about it. The Indianapolis Colts, albeit it was a short time, but went from Peyton Manning to Andrew Luck. And then you have some teams like the Bills, the Bears. Like, there's a reason why bad teams and bad organizations stay that way for a long time. This team seems to have found the right balance with Sean McDermott at the helm. Brandon Bean doesn't make a lot of moves that are bad moves, and as evidenced by his executive of the year this season. You know, the Josh Allen year, you talked about them bottoming out. They didn't even bottom out that year. They had to trade up in the draft because that was the year following them making the playoffs, right?
Forgot about that.
So, but yeah, you're right.
Yeah, forgot about that.
The one year that they were bad enough was the year that they drafted third and they took Marcell Dareus. That was the last time that they were really in that realm, and there wasn't a quarterback to take at that point. So some of it is luck of the draw, but they've put in the time with Allen, and Allen's put in the time himself to make himself this, you know, elite quarterback, the mechanics, everything. So to say that I'm excited for Sunday would be an absolute understatement. And I'm at the point now where I just don't want them just to be there. I want them to go out and I want them to win, because the guys talked about on Smith and Jones, you can't guarantee that you're going to be back here next year. So you better make the best of the situation that you're in and try and get there. We saw it with the Jays.
For sure.
You know, a couple deep playoff runs and you're left with nothing. So there's a lot to be said about the way this organization has gone. And hopefully that continues. Philip Rivers announced his retirement from the NFL, much to the surprise of no one. Drew Brees looks to be following him shortly out that door. But is Philip Rivers or Drew Brees going to be in an NFL broadcast booth soon? Maybe. We'll talk about that coming up after the break. This is Sportsnet Tonight on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and the Sportsnet Radio Network. Back to Sportsnet Tonight on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, and the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm your host, Matt Marchese, alongside me, my co-host, Josh Goldberg. And Josh mentioned it before the break, and Philip Rivers calls it a career, and I don't think anybody is really surprised by that. We saw, you know, even though he had a decent season, we saw the warts in his game. We saw the arm strength was certainly not what it used to be, and he decided to call it a career. He's accepted a position as a high school football coach in Alabama, which, okay, that's fine. But it was reported that as of the 2020 season, that a lot of networks were looking at Rivers to join one of their booths and become kind of the next Tony Romo. There's also talk that Drew Brees had a gig lined up with NBC to be that same thing. If you had your pick, whether it's Rivers or Brees or another quarterback in the game right now to be, you know, an analyst on a broadcast, who would you want that to be?
So I am honestly, I'm not super high on Drew Brees' prospects as a broadcaster. I feel like he maybe would be better in the studio than in a game, and I know they might be grooming him to be, you know, Chris Collinsworth's successor over there on NBC. Rivers would have been great, but he wants to go coach one of his 25 kids, I guess, playing football, so power to him. How about Baker Mayfield? I think Baker Mayfield would be a really good studio analyst or a really good in-game analyst. He's a good talker, good sense of humor, sharp tongue, everything that you want in an analyst he seems to have. And now it's a little less eye-rolling because he's put together a good year and they won a playoff game, so all the commercials and all of his quotes, you don't just roll your eyes anymore because he actually backed it up a little bit with a good season. So I think he could have a really bright future when long into the future he finishes playing. I think he could be a really good broadcaster.
So the guy that I pinpointed, and I'll be quick here because I know we got to take a break, but the guy that I pinpointed, and I don't think he'll ever do it. I believe he said that he has no interest in it, but man, Aaron Rodgers would be a lot of fun. If you watch his interviews that he does with Pat McAfee on Pat McAfee's show,
yeah.
I mean, they are so much fun. If there's a guy that I cheer for that's not on my team, it's Aaron Rodgers. He just seems like such a likable guy. He even did some stuff for the Barstool Fund, which again, I'm not a big Barstool guy myself, but they're doing great work in helping small businesses that are struggling during the pandemic. And Aaron Rodgers decided to just donate a bunch of money to this cause. Like, he's a guy that I really cheer for, and he seems like a guy that you would want to have a beer with, you know? So I think him on the broadcast would be a boatload of fun.
Yeah, I like that. And agreed, if you haven't seen those McAfee Rodgers interviews on Tuesdays, getting that kind of access and getting a quarterback, a player, an athlete like that to open up when you usually get these canned answers with the media, really, really good stuff. Can't recommend it enough.
Absolutely. So we've got plenty more to discuss here. And one of the things is the Raptors are struggling, and the Brooklyn Nets played their first game with the Big Three. Didn't quite go as planned. Sean Hyken of Bleacher Report will join us after the break. This is Sportsnet Tonight on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and the Sportsnet Radio Network.
When the sun goes down, we up the ante. This is Sportsnet Tonight on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Welcome back to Sportsnet Tonight, right here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm your host, Matt Marchese, and alongside me, my co-host, Josh Goldberg. And things here in Toronto, well, technically in Tampa Bay, have not quite been going as planned for the Raptors. A real rough start to the season, a little bit of hope after a three-game winning streak, and then losing to a very short-handed Miami Heat roster last night. Certainly not the way that anybody had planned that things go, but here we are. And joining us on the line to discuss that and some other notes around the NBA, Sean Hyken from Bleacher Report joins us. Sean, how are you tonight?
I'm doing all right. How about you guys?
We're good. And I mentioned the Raptor struggles, and they are well documented, but I kind of wanted to look a little bit, I guess, long term here with this franchise and this organization here. It's a shortened season. The top teams are by far and away better than what you have. Even if you tried to add a star, you're probably not as good as them. At what point do the Raptors look at this and say, just getting into the playoffs isn't good enough for us? We want to make a run. It's not going to be this year. We need to start looking at moving out some pieces to try and retool this thing.
Well, Masai's wanted to do that for, what, 8 years? Like, and the team was always just too good for that to happen. Remember, like going back to, what was that? What was the year they traded Rudy Gay to Sacramento, 2013? And then they were almost going to trade Kyle Lowry to the Knicks, and then they didn't, and then they accidentally started winning and made the playoffs for the first time in a few years, and then after that they were just too good to really justify blowing it up. I kind of feel like right now they're at the point where, you know, they have enough pieces. You know, they have OG, they have Van Vliet that they just re-signed. I know Kyle's kind of aging out of, you know, being, you know, the number one guy, but Siakam obviously struggled to start the season. He had started to look a little bit more like himself the last couple of weeks before he had that groin injury last night. But, yeah, they might just kind of be getting to the point where it's like, okay, you got a championship. You got the first championship in franchise history. And then they had a very good follow-up run with after Kawhi left. They, you know, they made the second round. They took Boston to seven games, almost made the conference finals. And then, you know, it just might be the end of the line. And, you know, if that is the end of the line, then, you know, they have some good pieces. It's not like they're going to be starting over with nothing. You know, you do whatever you do with Kyle, and then you just kind of, you know, you have Siakam, you have OG, you have Van Vliet. That, you could do a whole lot worse as a foundation to rebuild off.
Totally agreed, and it'll be interesting to see, you know, if they do get to that point with Lowry. And I wonder your thoughts if they do decide to move him. What do you think is a legitimate ask in a trade for Kyle Lowry, who's, like you said, up there in age, but still more nights than not an above average, even borderline elite point guard still? in the last year of his deal. Is he still somebody who can fetch, you know, a first-round pick plus, or do you have to consider the fact that you're getting him for a shortened stint and maybe the return isn't quite as high?
You could probably get a mid-first for him, like a protected pick. Maybe not, you know, not some insane amount of draft pick like what New Orleans got for Drew Holiday, for example. I don't think that's really going to be on the table for somebody his age, even though he's still pretty good. But, you know, you wouldn't be giving him away for nothing. You could probably get something. It's just a matter of just – and I realize they did this with DeMar, who was also kind of in the same status as, like, when he mentioned the franchise. That was to get Kawhi Leonard. That was a little bit of a different thing. But, like, if you're going to trade Kyle, like, it has to be kind of to the point, I feel like, where, you know, both you guys and – him are feeling like, you know, maybe it's time. And I mean, the other part of this is, you know, we still don't, I mean, you are probably more up on this than I am. Masai hasn't gotten his new deal done, has he?
No. That's a very big problem.
I mean, they just did an extension for Nick Nurse, and then they did one for Bobby Webster, correct?
I don't know if he's official yet. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's, like, going to happen, and the Nurse deal got done. Yes. You would think that means that.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I think that's a big part of, like if Toronto, like, if the Raptors were going to take a big swing, I think, you know, the opportunity was just there with James Harden available. They probably, you know, you could have, you know, given them Siakam and then, you know, whatever pick. You know, you have the pieces to get it done. But I would imagine, I don't know whether, you know, I don't know Masai or talk to Masai or, like, know any, you know, inside info here. But I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, if maybe, you know, if he even kicked the tires on it, and took that to ownership, and they might have been like, hey, you know, are you going to be here to make these draft picks? And we give up a whole bunch of future picks. Are you going to be here to deal with that? Or is it going to be a situation like Houston where they give up all these picks for Russell Westbrook and then Daryl Morey bails a year later?
Yeah, it's a really good point. And I the point that you made about the core of this team is very well put. It's better than a lot of teams that would be in this similar situation. The question becomes, where are you in the Eastern Conference? And I think that's what the Raptors need to figure out, because, you know, are you beating any of these teams this year? No. Could you beat them next year? Well, I guess it depends. But the Lowry thing to me is the most interesting, because they could just have a handshake deal and say, hey, listen, we'll trade you now, we'll get something for you, and then we'll bring you back.
You mean like just like on a shorter term deal?
Yeah, after, because he's as far as I know, he's on an expiring deal. So, you know, yeah. we've seen those under the table deals before. That would be probably the least surprising thing I think that could happen. Like you said, given his status in this organization,
I could see it. I don't know. I mean, now as far as where the Raptors are at, in the East, obviously, you know, without. I mean, I think losing, I mean, this season is just so weird for them, just because, you know, you're not playing in your home arena, even your home games. You're playing basically on the road. You're playing 72 road games while everybody else is playing 36 home and 36 road. So they're just kind of in a disadvantage there. But then also, like, you know, obviously losing both Ibaka and Gasol hurt. And then, you know, everybody else is just kind of trying to adjust, because those two guys were such mainstays the last couple of years. As far as where they would be long term, obviously, given how much star power some of those other teams have, you got Giannis in Milwaukee. Now you have these three guys together in Brooklyn. You've got Simmons and Embiid in Philly, and Embiid is playing like probably an MVP front runner right now. And then you've got Tatum and Brown in Boston, and then that's to say nothing of Miami, which, you know, Miami hasn't really been fully healthy. They've had guys in and out. Jimmy Butler hasn't really played that much, but. So you don't really, you know, we don't really know what to make. They're kind of in the same spot right now that the Raptors are in, where they, you know, you would think that, you know, they're running back most of the team they had last year, but, you know, they've had guys out. They've, you know, guys have, you know, gotten off to slow starts. You can't really evaluate it yet. But I would say, I mean, I think Toronto, even this year, I think they still have enough to make the playoffs. I just don't anymore put them in the category of teams that I could see making a serious run to the finals like I did last year.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much it. Like, maybe the worst, they get in the play-in, and then maybe they put a scare into somebody in the first round. But beyond that, yeah, it would be hard to expect much. I got to say, I don't really know what to make of the Eastern Conference right now. Like, you mentioned Philly, you mentioned Boston. Milwaukee's losing to the Lakers right now. I'm not really sure what to make of them. Brooklyn, they can't play defense. They got tuned up by Cleveland and Colin Sexton last night. Like, is the East just a mess? Who do you think is most likely of this group of teams right now, this group of maybe five teams, to really put it together, emerge, and be the de facto team to beat in the conference?
I've given up trying to predict what anything is going to be, especially this season where there's just so much. Like, we don't even know when the finals are going to be because of just the way that the schedule is, because they're going to have to make it. Like, they have tentatively an idea of when it's scheduled, but they're going to have to make up so many games on the back end that have gotten pushed back in the last couple of weeks that this is a year. I'm not great with predictions as it is, but especially this year, there's just so much stuff going on and so many extenuating circumstances. On paper, I think I kind of, just based on what we've seen so far, I'm kind of leaning towards Philly, just because obviously, you know, Embiid is playing like an MVP right now, and it's just the pieces that they put around him make a lot more sense. You know, Tobias Harris is having a great year. You know, he's back with Doc Rivers, who he played his best basketball of his career with the Clippers before. And now, you know, Doc is there, and you know, he's having a much better year than I think he did last year. So I kind of like Philly right now, but you could tell me any of those four or five teams won the East and it wouldn't shock me, assuming Miami kind of gets back to themselves at some point once they get some guys back. Those are the five teams I would kind of put in there.
Sean Hyken is our guest NBA reporter for Bleacher Report. And, you know, Josh mentioned the Brooklyn Nets and how they can't play defense. So last night was the first game that we see the big three together in a game. And it goes to double overtime and, you know, Colin Sexton lights him up. And all three guys individually had really good games. But this is not a slam dunk, and pardon the pun, but it's not a slam dunk for Steve Nash as a rookie head coach to deal with these three egos. Like, I want to see long term here, or I guess longer term this season, how Kyrie Irving feels about being, you know, the third guy that gets the ball in this offense. Like, there's a lot of egos to manage, and it doesn't seem like it's all that easy for a rookie head coach, even someone of Steve Nash's stature in the game.
Yeah, I've been skeptical the whole time. Obviously, the talent level with those three together is off the charts. Now, it's actually kind of funny when you talk about what the Nets, you know, question marks are. Because going into the season, to me, their biggest question mark was, what is Kevin Durant going to look like? He's coming off a torn Achilles, which is usually a really bad injury, and guys, they're never really the same when they come back from. So what's Kevin Durant going to look like? Kevin Durant is basically the most known quantity on the team right now. He looks exactly like Kevin Durant before the injury. He looks like the best player in the world right now, or close to it. So, I mean, anytime you have him and he's playing at that level, you're going to be able to probably figure some things out. And Harden has looked incredible since he got there. It's pretty obvious now that he basically had been mailing it in for a while in Houston. When you look at how he's been playing in Houston versus as soon as he gets to Brooklyn, he has two amazing games in a row, and then he was still pretty good. Even I know he didn't take that many shots early on last night against the Cavs, but I don't know. The whole thing is just so interesting, and then there's, you know, the Kyrie part of it, and even leaving out some of, you know, the other, you know, the off court stuff with him, because I feel like that's just sort of all been litigated to death. But like, he's the third best player out of those three, and he has, it's been clear at different times in his career that he doesn't like not being the guy. I mean, he obviously won a championship playing next to LeBron in Cleveland, and he was able to play off the ball, but he didn't like it. He ended up wanting out, and then kind of the same thing happened in Boston, where he got there, he thought he was going to be the guy, and then, you know, suddenly, you know, it's Jaylen Brown, it's Jason Tatum, and then he doesn't really like that situation either. So I don't know how it's all going to work out. Like, I mean, the talent level is there. Obviously, you have, you know, three of the best offensive players in the league, but I don't know if they're going to be able to guard anybody, and just the fit is just kind of, I feel like we might all look stupid if they figure this out and they're just going to be destroying teams in the playoffs, but I don't want to say that it's going to, you know, for sure that's going to be how it is, because I could see it going sideways also.
Well, I look at what's going on right now. They're playing six guys. Like, Durant played 50 minutes last night, Harden 51. Irving hasn't played in weeks. He played 48. A team playing Jeff Green, even though he had a nice night, 45 minutes. Joe Harris, 42. I understand it's a double overtime game. They don't really have anyone else. I worry that over the course of the season and the playoffs, you know, James Harden has run out of gas every year in the playoffs, you could argue. Playing 51 minutes, and I understand there's other guys to take the burden off, but you play 40 minutes a night, that's going to take its toll. I just don't think that they have enough viable bodies outside of their big three, and I guess maybe to an extent Joe Harris.
They'll get guys, though, is the thing. Like, there's always guys on the buyout market once you get into, I guess in this case, February and March, once you get closer to the playoffs, whatever the timeline ends up being for when the playoffs are going to start or when the buyout deadline is, there's always going to be somebody, you know, whether you look at, you know, over the, you know, various years, there's always like one or two guys that gets bought out and then ends up playing, you know, Markieff Morris with the Lakers last year. Actually, both of the Morris twins got the, you know, end up, you know, being these midseason guys. I guess Marcus was a trade, but yeah, Markieff Morris gets bought out by the, was he with, whoever he was with, he gets bought out. He goes to the Lakers. God, that was like almost 18 months ago or 2 years ago at this point. But like, he gets bought out, goes to the Lakers, plays a big role on their championship team. Like, there's always one or two guys like that. So, and I think they'll get somebody. They'll have more depth by the time you get to the playoffs. I'm not that worried about it, but it is true. They really don't have a lot of guys. I mean, you're right. You're basically looking at those three, and then like DeAndre Jordan is basically your only center left now that you traded Jared Allen in the deal, and then Joe Harris. Like, I don't know. I mean, maybe we're overthinking this, and maybe just the talent of those three is going to just win out over everything. But it's not a perfect roster by any means.
Markieff Morris was with the Detroit Pistons before when he got bought.
That sounds
so that's what we were looking for there. But you know, Sean. We talk about the top-end talent on a lot of these teams, and it does feel like one of those years, and maybe I'm just overthinking this, because it feels like there's only four or five teams that can win it this year. It doesn't feel like, you know, a team could surprise. Like, Denver pushed some teams to the brink last year. I don't know if that's going to happen again, because I feel like the Clippers are going to take that step forward, unlike last year where they totally, you know, buckled under the pressure. The Lakers are going to be the Lakers because they're really good. I still think that despite the fact that the Nets can't play a lick of defense, that they're going to be there as well. And the Bucks and Sixers. So four or five teams that can win it. Is that good for the NBA? Or are we just kind of over that fact now and it's just, you know, these same teams are gonna be in it every year and star power wins over, you know, having a good team with, you know, one or two guys maybe?
What are you going to do? Honestly, that's kind of where, unless you want to just get rid of free agency and get rid of trades and just make everybody stay with the team that drafted them their entire career. Like, what are you going to do? But honestly, though, who are the two teams that made it out of the East the last 2 years? Nobody really, I don't think anybody really had Miami making the finals. When you look at, you know, who were considered the favorites going into the playoffs last year, it was Milwaukee, it was Boston, it was, you know, to a lesser extent, Philly. Miami was just kind of not really, they were a five seed, if I'm right, I don't remember, they were four or five with Indy, but they, you know, they weren't seen as one of the favorites. And then the Raptors the year before, everybody was talking that whole year about the Bucks, and then it turns out Toronto, like, it is still, and even like the year that, you know, the Warriors made the finals, they weren't one of the teams that, you know, the first year in 2015, they weren't like going into that season as, oh, the Warriors are going to be unstoppable this year, and then they just were. Like, this stuff kind of always happens. Like, I mean, maybe it's totally predictable this year, and it's the Lakers and the Nets or the Lakers and the Sixers, and it's just kind of what everybody saw coming. But, you know, there's the last 2 years, the team coming out of the East wasn't necessarily the team that everybody had coming out of the East going into the playoffs. So I think these surprises do happen. I don't think it's just kind of decided beforehand that, you know, this is who's going to win.
Yeah, it's just, to me, I look at the way that this season's unfolding right now, and you're right, all of the uncertainty is very valid. When is this season going to end? I think you know, this is the first time, I guess, since the Warriors, and not nowhere near to that extent. But I look at the Lakers in their own tier, and then everyone else is just trying to measure up to the Lakers. Because, like, right now, they're 11-4, and you could argue that they're playing not at in their full gear. Like, they dial it up, they dial it down, and they're still 11-4. I just feel like when they go to Davis at the five and they're locked into that playoff rotation, it's hard to see anyone beating them four times in seven games.
I'm with you. I haven't seen anything this year that makes me think that any other team is really on their level. But I don't know. Weird stuff happens in the playoffs. Maybe Anthony Davis gets hurt. Maybe LeBron loses, a step. I don't think that's going to happen, but it's possible. You know, the Clippers look a lot better this year. Utah's kind of interesting, even. I don't know. I would guess. I mean, I would say the Lakers are probably like a prohibitive favorite in the West at this point, but I don't think it's anywhere near the level of, you know, some of those Warrior seasons where, like, you know, going into the season, there's just no chance anybody else is even going to, be on their level.
Yeah. Sean, thanks a lot for taking some time for us today. Great stuff as always, and hopefully we'll check back in with you next time we're on. Appreciate it, man.
Yeah, take care, guys.
Sean Hyken from Bleacher Report, and Josh, as we look around the NBA, which team for you would be, you know, the biggest surprise? Let's say outside of the Raptors, because I think that one is way out there. Which team stands out to you as a big surprise, a good or bad?
Let's see. I guess Indiana can't be that much of a surprise because they made the playoffs last year. But, you know, they traded Oladipo. Sabonis, to me, is incredible how consistent he's been. Cleveland has been a surprise. Like, I don't think they're making the playoffs or anything. They could make the play-in tournament. Like, there's a couple, like Cleveland, Atlanta, New York right now occupying 6-8. Miami's on the outside looking in, and obviously the Raptors are on the outside looking in. Cleveland's probably not making the playoffs because they can't play defense. And, you know, there's some issues, like, just in terms of fit of some of the pieces there. But they're a fun team to watch. So is Atlanta. So is New York. They play hard for Tibbs. You look at it, and I guess, like, Dallas has been a bit of a disappointment so far, but Porzingis has been hurt. Denver at 7-7 has definitely been a big-time disappointment. And I wonder what's going on with New Orleans. Everyone has just assumed that the pieces would fit together. Zion would take another step, and he's looked great at plenty of times this year, but I wonder what's going on there. Like, are they just, maybe not quite as good as people thought they might be or hoped they might be? They're 5-8. They struggle defensively. You know, they're giving up 110 points per game. I wonder about them. Like, I just don't see that ceiling there of them being anything to write home about in the Western Conference. Like, if they make the playoffs or get into the play-in and then get into the playoffs, like, they're roadkill in the first round, realistically. And to me, that would be a disappointment, I think, relative to what a lot of people expected from them this year.
Yeah, I'm going to go with the Nuggets. After what we saw in the playoffs last season, I really, really expected them to be among the more elite teams in the NBA. And we saw Jamal Murray take that step into, maybe not superstardom, but pretty close to it. Like, he was excellent in the bubble last year, and he put the rest of the NBA on notice for how good he was. But this Nuggets team is playing 500 basketball right now, 7-7. Jokic is such a fun player to watch, but you just wonder about how long they can go with this group, because clearly in the Western Conference, you need star power, and I think Jokic is there and Murray's there, but they're not quite in that tier that helps push you over the top, and I wonder if they need to go out and try and make a move to bring in a star and really push them, because they have some talent. But I don't know if clearly they're not quite there yet.
Well, I think the loss of Jeremy Grant has been large. A lot of people expected that would be a blow for them and one that might be tough to overcome a little bit, or one at least tough to replace. Michael Porter Jr. also, has missed 10 games because he's an idiot, right, with the coronavirus protocols that he's violated a couple of times, and he might be a bit of an anti-vaxxer. Like, he's an immature, probably stupid kid who needs to figure some stuff out. But that doesn't take away from the fact that before he vanished, he was averaging 20 points points and seven boards and was super efficient and was that third guy and maybe was going to replace Grant. So you have to maybe factor that in a little bit, that him being out has taken some bite away from them. Like Jokic to me, he's averaging a triple-double. Jokic is a superstar. I'm confident and comfortable in saying that you can win a championship with Nikola Jokic as the best player on your team, as the fulcrum of your team, as somebody who you can run everything through. I'm confident in that. And honestly, I think you can win a champ. I honestly think you could win a championship with Jokic and Murray as your top two players. If Porter can figure it out and get back on the court, you know, you look at the rest of that roster, Morris, Michael Green's been good. Millsap, Harris, Dozier's been pretty solid this year. I still think they're going to get it together. And if I'm picking a team again in the Western Conference who I think can probably push the Lakers, it's Denver. It's not the Clippers, as much as people probably want to say, well, they look great, the ball movement's better, they're shooting the ball great. That's it. They're shooting the ball at an unsustainable clip. I just feel like mentally, if you can push them a bit, I just don't know if they're mentally tough enough top to bottom to not crack again. Denver has that experience. You know, they didn't really push the Lakers last year. It was a five-game series. But if I had to pick one team at full strength in the Western Conference to really breathe down the neck of the defending champions, it would be Denver again.
Yeah, the Michael Porter Jr. is a good point because, he was a consensus, you know, top 3 to 5 pick, and then he had the injury, and then everybody kind of, he just fell into the lap of the Nuggets. And, you know, I don't even think he might be an anti-vaxxer. I'm pretty sure he is. So, you know, he does have to figure out whether he wants to play basketball or not. But, you know, you make some good points about the Nuggets. They're a fun team to watch. They're a team that I kind of root for in the Western Conference because, you know, LeBron, and I know you're a Lakers fan, and that's fine. It's more just like I kind of want to see somebody take a step, and a team that the Nuggets feel like they've kind of been on the cusp for about 4 or 5 years now. And it just hasn't come through, and I'm hoping that they can finally break through. Speaking of breaking through, the Blue Jays broke through with the acquisition or signing of George Springer. They also brought in some arms, and their pitching coach joined Scotty Mack and Hazel May earlier today on Leadoff. You'll hear that interview coming up after the break. This is Sportsnet Tonight on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and the Sportsnet Radio Network. Sportsnet Tonight on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm your host, Matt Marchese. Alongside me, Josh Goldberg. You can follow us on Twitter at MattSN590 and at JGoldberg12. Don't forget to check out our poll question for the evening. Now that you've seen the Canadian division through the first little while, do you want to see it going forward? You can check that out on Twitter. You can also you can text us at 590-590 with your name and location. You want to see it going forward? Let us know. Earlier today on Leadoff with Scotty Mack and guest host Hazel May, they were joined by pitching coach Pete Walker. And here's that conversation.
Two big acquisitions this offseason.
Sure.
Kirby Yates the other day. Man, was he great for the Pods in 18 and 19. Had some injuries last year.
Yep.
And Tyler Chatwood, who... at times for the Cubs, couldn't hit the backside of a barn, but has plus stuff and good advanced metrics outside of the walks. What can those two guys bring to your bullpen, Pete?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we've been making some upgrades. You got Springer and you got Yates, and I don't think Chatwood has been announced officially, but obviously it's in the works. But our bullpen was good last year for sure. Jordan Romano, Ryan Borucki, Rafael Dolis. We lost Anthony Bass, but brought back A.J. Cole. So we already have some good pieces in place. And then to add arms like that is it just strengthens an already strong area for us. So as far as I'm concerned, so we got a lot of power down there. A guy like, you know, Kirby Yates was exceptional. You look at his strikeout to walk ratio, strikeout to inning ratio in 19, and what he can do to the baseball now. He's made some adjustments with that split finger fastball. So he is the definite back end guy that can close games for us and, you know, pitch in the highest leverage situation. So, and I'm sure his kind of experience will rub off on the Jordan Romanos, the Ryan Baruckis. We already got Rafael Dolis, who, you know, quietly went about his business last year and was one of the better relievers in baseball. And, you know, I think people recognize that, but really wasn't talked about a lot. So we're excited about that group. And, you know, looking forward to this year, obviously, you know, when you have a strong bullpen to finish games, it shortens the game a little bit. When you get some strong middle relief in there as well to pick up that fifth, sixth, seventh inning at times, that's really the glue between the cracks, you know, and I think a guy like Chatwood can certainly fill that kind of a role.
So you lose Anthony Bass, but you guys get Robbie Ray back. Yeah. And early too. And I know you and I talked, you were a big fan of his and he of you. And my question is, it was interesting how you two kind of interacted. And you told me that when you get a new guy, you let him go and pitch, Pete, and then you talk afterwards. Like, how's that process getting to know the pitcher and then analyzing and evaluating what you need to do to help him?
Yeah, you're spot on. I mean, I talked to Robbie, and usually guys that come in for the first time, you know, you got to understand that they've probably been through a lot in their previous organization or organizations. There's been changes. There's been people that have been in their ear. And I think the biggest thing is to kind of let them be themselves again. And, you know, with him, obviously we had some ideas, and we kind of talked about them. But to let him pitch his game a little bit and then to kind of make those adjustments is really critical to get buy-in from a player and to let them, you know, there's got to be some trust there. So, and then when it works, you know, you're really smart. but with Robbie, I mean, he, as you know, everybody knows his stuff is exceptional.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, went through some mechanical changes, some arm changes as far as his arm swing, got him back to, you know, his old arm stroke. And he was very comfortable with us. I know there were a few walks, but they weren't wild walks. And I think looking forward to this season, he's already chomping at the bit. He feels like he's on the right path. He feels comfortable coming into spring training. So we do. You get him in the box throwing strikes, his stuff, as we saw at times, was overpowering. So, you know, we're very fortunate to have him. You know, I think he's looking to have a big season. He put himself kind of back on the map, I think, at the end of last year with some outings for sure. And, you know, we're counting on him to be a big part of that rotation.
Kirby Yates was tremendous in 2019, as you know. He did have the, you know, the surgery to remove bone spurs. That, and I don't know, I'm asking, yeah. Pete, that surgery, not as invasive. There's no structural damage. So do you think does that help him, you know, get back to form quicker? And, you know, are you guys more encouraged that he didn't have any structural damage and that you guys could hopefully get him back into shape?
Yeah, I don't usually comment too much on the injury part, but he is healthy. He is throwing the ball great right now, feels great. And yeah, those kind of surgeries are very minor.
Okay.
And they're not unusual across baseball for sure. So we're excited to have him. And, you know, again, he's going to be a big part of that bullpen. You know, I've talked to him a number of times, you know, through text as well. And he is excited to be part of this organization and pitch for Toronto. He knows what we have from a young core. And, you know, I just think he's going to be a big part of that bullpen. And we're counting on him to do what he did in 18 and 19.
With Pete Walker, the pitching coach of the Blue Jays, leadoff, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. So you've got a big league pitcher. Doesn't matter what his name is. And he's, I guess it doesn't matter his age, but he's, let's just say he's a younger, still somewhat unrefined product, but his stuff is inarguable. How do you go about refining him so that he maxes his potential? You know, there are a lot of buzzwords now, Pete, spin rate, velocity.
Yeah, yeah.
There's the Rapsodo machine. There's the this, the that, the analytics out the yin yang, which has probably changed a lot since you first became a pitching coach almost a decade ago. Sorry to make you feel old. Like, so how do you put all of that together to create the best guy the guy can be?
Well, that's kind of what we do, to be honest with you. And, you know, there are the technology that's available we utilize. Our organization's come a long way in that area for sure from when I started to now. We actually have a pitching lab that's in the new complex, which I'm so excited to get down to see. Those are all incredible things, and that's really what we do. Without, you know, being overbearing or confusing the pitcher, there's information we can provide. You know, Matt Bushman does a great job, especially with the player development right now, because he's kind of directing a lot of the minor league stuff as well as helping out the big league pitchers. He does a fantastic job. Our front office, as far as breaking down data and providing it, I think we're in a good place when it comes to those things, so we're not really missing anything. But with that being said, it is very important not to confuse the pitcher and to steer him in a wrong direction or in a direction that he's uncomfortable with or maybe doesn't get good results, because then you kind of lose that trust. So it's a fine line of information that we provide, and it depends on the individual how much they want and how much they need. But obviously, to get the best out of them to maximize their ability is what we need to do and what we try to do. A guy like Nate Pearson, a guy like Julian Merriweather, you know, they love the technology, and, you know, we've seen them maximize their stuff because of it. So it's today's game. It's the way of the future. But again, there's always that fine line of simplifying things and trying not to overwhelm young pitchers, for sure. And that's kind of my job.
Can a guy significantly increase spin rate? Is that possible?
I don't think it's significantly. I mean, there's always improvements in certain areas. And, you know, I think the biggest thing is to find out where an individual is. You know, the biggest thing is changing grips sometimes, you know, finding the seam. We use some technology, some video cameras that are very – You can see everything. You can see the first rotation of the ball. You can see where the fingers are on the baseball. So you can make some adjustments with just a slight hand grip and movement on the baseball and increase some spin. But the main thing is it really just provides us with information on guys, so we know what pitches would work best and what pitches would work best off of each other. You know, when you talk about sequences and utilizing different pitches. So that's the main area there, where we get that kind of information. It helps us kind of project guys and make sure they're throwing the correct pitches.
I know a lot of guys are already in Dunedin at the Player Development Complex. You said you're excited to see it. We all kind of took a tour when it was, you know, still being constructed. But is there something in that development complex for you, Pete, that you think – you know, really stands out and could be a game changer for your pitchers? Is there like a pitching lab?
Yeah, there is. We've built the pitching lab, which I'm excited to see. It's probably going to be the most fun to be able to get individual, you know, get a guy in there and take a look at his delivery, break him down mechanically, you know, see if there are any deficiencies that, you know, that show up that maybe we haven't seen with the naked eye, for sure. Obviously, we'll have Rapsodo and have different technology as well to check the spin on certain pitches. So that's going to be a lot of fun. The guys are going to love that. So looking forward to utilizing that area. Obviously, the weight room is incredible. It's state of the art. It's probably the best in all of sport. So, and the outside fields are state of the art. It's just from what we've had in the past to where we are now, it's just a total game changer, a new game. The guys that are down in Florida are loving it and they don't want to leave. So that's the kind of facility we built, and it's going to be very attractive to potential players in the future as well coming in. So it's really an exciting time for the Blue Jays.
And that's what I was going to ask you next is, having a complex like that, you know, is that advantageous when you're trying to sign guys?
I would think. I mean, you know, again, I'm not in their shoes, but when we start to get wind of what kind of facility and what kind of direction the organization's going in, obviously that's attractive. So I think players today are very up on the technology, and they love new things, and they love state-of-the-art equipment, and that's exactly what they provided for us down there. So, you know, it's, again, I played here in 02, 03, 05, 06, and I saw the old facility, and there really wasn't much of a change for a long time at that time. So to see where we are now is just so exciting. And I got to give Mark and Ross a lot of credit, obviously, for providing the players with this kind of facility. The coaches obviously love it. And it's for a working environment, there's going to be nothing better.
Pete Walker is the pitching coach of the Blue Jays. This is leadoff Sportsnet 590, The Fan. So a couple of quick questions on two of your bigger names. Hyunjin Ryu, the preference to pitch every 6 day versus every 5 days. Is that how you envision the plan with him, or what's the...
Well, I don't know if he prefers every 6 day. I mean, obviously his numbers are a little bit better on those days, as we know. But, you know, you look across baseball, to be honest with you, and there are a lot of guys that are better with an extra day of rest. So I don't want to put too much into that right now. Obviously, it depends on the makeup of our rotation when all is said and done. I love the guys we have. I think there's some ways to maneuver and to shorten games, obviously, especially with the potential bullpen we have. We have some middle guys that could certainly be very advantageous to this rotation. But, yeah, I mean, Hyunjin Ryu, I still envision him pitching, you know, every 5th day. And when we can get days to push him back, I'm sure we would. But, again, those are all discussions we'll have as we get into spring training. We see that, obviously, that everybody's 100% and healthy and throwing great. You know, it seems like there's always a hiccup in spring training, just about every organization with somebody, right? So we're just trying to build depth right now. We certainly have some young guys who are chomping at the bit to start in the big leagues. And, you know, it's going to be good competition. And there's still a lot of unanswered questions as far as how we're going to utilize certain guys during the season. And again, it's the main thing is we want to get into spring training. You know, I got 30 plus pitchers in camp. And get a chance to watch these guys work and really looking forward to, you know, good, healthy competition and guys hungry to perform at the major league level.
That was Blue Jays pitching coach Pete Walker earlier today on Leadoff with Scotty Mack and guest host Hazel May. And Josh, you know, I really enjoy listening to Pete Walker talk because he kind of gives you an insight on these pitchers and what he likes and what he doesn't like. But what I really enjoyed hearing was just the faith they have in themselves as an organization to make these guys better, to take them to the next level. And Hazel mentioned about Robbie Ray and how excited Robbie Ray was to, you know, to get back into things and work again with Pete Walker. That to me goes a long way because I think a lot of these players talk and that talk gets around the league. And maybe that's one of the reasons why a guy like George Springer decided to sign here, because he understands, you know, the care that this organization takes in their players.
Yeah, an inclusive organization goes a long way, right? Like in terms of just like having an open line of communication, involving the player in a number of different things. You know, sports science, I think, has become increasingly utilized and leaned on, especially for pitchers, and Pete Walker has definitely embraced that. And you can see that Pete Walker and basically every pitcher on this staff and certainly in the rotation have a pretty good relationship and seem to be simpatico when it comes to, you know, operating on the same wavelength and their plan and how they want to go about executing it. And, you know, maybe that beckons to somebody like a Trevor Bauer who wants an inclusive type of situation. And obviously his emphasis on importance in terms of data and stuff of that sort is huge. And I wonder, you know, how much Pete Walker can play into that. I think certainly a lot. And it was a huge move to keep him as part of the staff and as the pitching coach after John Gibbons left and Charlie Montoya was brought in. You know, there was some uncertainty whether he would stay, and he ended up staying, and that was obviously huge for the Jays. And yeah, I just feel like they're in a good spot right now. Obviously, their young core and making the playoffs even in a 60-game season goes a long way. But yeah, you see a young, up-and-coming team with a lot of talent that is only going to get better, you would think, and a payroll that is only going to go up, and an ownership and front office that has been public in their declaration for spending. And when it came to Springer, they were obviously very, very interested and vocal about it. That's got to make you feel good. And yeah, I'm sure that obviously ended up going a very long way and carrying a ton of weight for George Springer, and was probably the biggest reason that he decided that he was comfortable in making the commitment for 6 years with Toronto.
Yeah, absolutely. I really like the direction that this team is going, like you said, and there's some pieces in place here that they can make a real run. The Detroit Lions introduced their new head coach today, and his opening of his press conference was interesting, to say the least. You'll hear it coming up after this. This is Sportsnet Tonight on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and the Sportsnet Radio Network. Welcome back to Sportsnet Tonight on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm your host, Matt Marchese. Alongside me, Josh Goldbergen. The Detroit Lions seem to do things a little bit differently than a lot of organizations. They hired Matt Patricia because he was going to be great in the Bill Belichick tree, and they fired Jim Caldwell, who had just come off a winning season, and they're a mess. They just hired Dan Campbell, who was the tight ends coach and assistant to the head coach with the New Orleans Saints. He also had a brief stint as an interim head coach with the Miami Dolphins after Joe Philbin was fired in 2015. But Josh, this is, to me, this is a bizarre hire, but nothing was more bizarre than what he said at his press conference today.
This place has been kicked, it's been battered, it's been bruised, and I can sit up here and give you coach speak all day long. I can give you, hey, we're going to win this many games. I can't, none of that matters, and you guys don't want to hear it anyway. You've had enough of that shit, so excuse my language, all right? Here's what I do know, is that this team is going to take on the identity of this city, all right? And this city's been down, and it found a way to get up. All right, it's found a way to overcome adversity. All right, and so this team's going to be built on, we're going to kick you in the teeth. All right, and when you punch us back, we're going to smile at you. And when you knock us down, we're going to get up. And on the way up, we're going to bite a kneecap off. All right, and we're going to stand up. And then it's going to take two more shots to knock us down. All right, and on the way up, we're going to take your other kneecap, and we're going to get up. And then it's going to take three shots to get us down. And when we do, we're going to take another hunk out of you. Before long, we're going to be the last one standing. All right, that's going to be the mentality.
I mean, just there's a lot to unpack here, but
yeah,
like, does this not feel like they just rehired Matt Patricia?
Well, how many coaches have won press conferences, you know, with fiery, passionate speeches? You know, if the team stinks, the roster stinks, generally speaking, it doesn't matter who your coach is, right? Like, there are exceptions to the rule, but if their roster looks the way that it did this year, they're going to be bad again next year, even if they want to kick in the teeth and, you know, take a hunk out or whatever it was that he was saying. Like, it's all, like, all that rah-rah stuff is nice for introductory press conferences, but then you really get between the lines there with the roster that you have, it's that stuff fades away pretty quickly, and I imagine a lot of players get sick of that kind of stuff pretty quickly too.
It was pretty funny. He's like, you know, you don't want to hear about all the losses that this team has. You don't want to hear about that bleep. And then he goes on to talk about and talks in these hyperbole that nobody wants to hear even more than all the losses that the organization's had. Like, it was to me, I feel like the Lions really kind of missed the boat here. They gave a 6-year deal to a guy that it seemed like nobody else was interviewing. I mean, like I said, the Lions do things differently. Like, they were still giving Adrian Peterson carries instead of DeAndre Swift at the end of the year, which is completely and utterly mind-blowing. But to give a guy, how about you give him a 3-year deal? How about we go there instead? Like, it's not nearly as egregious as the Oakland Raiders giving John Gruden a 10-year deal, but man, it feels pretty close.
Well, what percentage are we giving Dan Campbell of finishing that 6-year contract? Zero? Are we going 0%?
No, because I don't think anything is a, you know, an impossibility, but I would say it's like at most it's 10, like 10% chance.
At most.
And I think that's really high. Yeah. And now, having said that, Dan Campbell could turn out to be this brilliant head coach, and maybe I'm wrong about it, but it just feels like one of those hires that they just messed up again.
Yeah, I would imagine, you know, the Lions are the Lions for a reason. They're probably going to get rid of Stafford. Hope for the best. You know, I hope it works out for Dan Campbell, but that kind of talk doesn't inspire a ton of confidence out of the gates for me.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll tell you what didn't inspire a ton of confidence, and that's professional athletes taking the proper care with these COVID protocols. And the Washington Capitals were hit with a big fine, especially in today's day of not having fans in the stands. $100,000 is a lot of money. We'll talk about that with Annie O'Donnell next, host of the OD on Sports podcast. She's on the West Coast, and she also follows the Ducks. And unfortunately, Josh, she's also a Ravens fan, so I'm going to have to rub a little bit of salt in the wound there. That's coming up on Sportsnet tonight, here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Nights ranked in reverse order. Date night, medieval night, and number one, Sportsnet tonight. Tonight on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Welcome back to Sportsnet tonight on Sportsnet 590, The Fan and the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm your host, Matt Marchese. Alongside me, Josh Goldberg. And I can tell you this, one thing that nobody's ever called me is Mr. Brightside. It's usually the exact opposite in our part of the world there, Josh.
Yeah, me too. I guess a lesser extent. I guess I'm not really Mr. Chipper. I was. It depends on the situation, the subject matter. Sometimes I can be. Generally, I'm not. But I'm trying to be, especially these days.
Yeah, I generally just dislike people, so it's really easy for me to be a grump. But the one thing that I can say I was really happy about, and our next guest is going to take the brunt of this. I'll introduce her first before I really rub salt in the wound here. But Annie O'Donnell's our guest, host of the OD on Sports podcast. Annie, I told you that I would have you on win or lose for my Bills, and unfortunately for you, it was Bills win.
I knew we were going to get this out of the way first, so might as well. All right. First of all, congratulations to you and Bills Mafia. If the Ravens had to get ousted by anybody, I'm glad it was the Bills. I will be rooting for them for the Super Bowl, but still stings. Still stings. I got chirped at this morning at the gym, too, from a trainer because I was wearing a Ravens shirt. And I was like, I can't escape this. Even in California, I can't escape this.
Hey, you know what? Listen, as a Bills fan, we've dealt with a lot of vitriol and just being the laughingstock. So it's nice to have that change. But I wanted to go in a different direction here and get on the hockey page with you. There's been a lot of issues around the NHL with, you know, positive COVID tests. We saw the outbreak with Dallas. Other teams have had their issues, the Panthers, the Hurricanes. It just keeps going and going and going. The Capitals are the next team that has kind of been hit here, and they got a big fine. And then Alex Ovechkin's wife takes to Instagram, and just a long rant about how it was only the Russian players that were together in the same hotel room. None of the other players ever get together, and, you know, they hug each other after they score, all this stuff. I guess she's got a point here.
I completely agree with her, and seriously, I am not downplaying COVID or the severity at all and how teams need to be careful and, you know, in order to keep the season going so we don't have outbreaks that delay the season like the NFL had been dealing with all season and how Major League Baseball had to combat that early on. But she's absolutely right. I mean, these guys are around each other all the time. Maybe it's just me here, but I don't understand what the big deal is about getting together in a hotel room. And are we supposed to believe that these guys are literally staying in their hotel rooms the entire time on the road? It doesn't make sense to me, and it just seems so stupid. If I'm a Caps fan, if I have any Capitals on my fantasy team, which I personally do right now, I am extremely frustrated, specifically Kuznetsov and Ovi. So I don't blame her frustration whatsoever.
The biggest problem I have with everything going on right now is I understand, you know, you're kind of just trying to piece this thing together as best as you can because we're dealing with a once in a century or more situation. But, you know, the NBA saying that, you know, we're going to have enforcement officers to make sure stuff isn't going on after the game, but you're having guys playing each other. I guess they're like, they still haven't proven that if you can transmit it while you're playing. It just like, there seems to be just way too much in the way of inconsistency. inconsistencies. And it's just, it seems like it's asking a lot in these situations of these players. You know, they're all over the place. They're getting different, confusing messaging. It's just, it's easy to beat them up for it, but it's got to be really difficult considering all of the very easy to break protocols and all of the very inconsistent messaging.
Absolutely. And you think back to the playoffs when they were all in two secluded bubbles, and then, of course, in the conference finals, all going into one where, you know, no one's going in and out of the bubble. Everybody's safe. So it's pretty easy to, you know, I wouldn't say easy, but, you know, there's interaction with people. You know you're going to be safe when you interact. Whereas you go into this situation where, you know, you have the divisions, you know, Canada stays in Canada. You got the, you know, Northwest. I think I'm missing, what, East and is it South or Central? Central, excuse me. But, you know, different protocols, and like the NFL is dealing with, you know, their people are going back home. They're going to their families, you know, their wives, kids who are, you know, some places they're going to school and some places they're going out and seeing people. Like, you know, the NFL had to deal with this year too. Like, you can only do so much as far as restrictions on, you know, where players can go and what they can see, who they can see, what they can do. I know a lot of teams are, you know, the families are kind of saying, hey, let's only do play dates and hanging out with each other just so we kind of have a team bubble going on here. But other than that, I mean, they're kind of navigating this the same way we all are.
Andy O'Donnell is our guest, host of the OD on Sports podcast. Just quickly, because I'm watching the game right now, what is going on with the Colorado Avalanche and these blue pants? I don't know whose idea this was, but it was a bad one.
You don't like them? I think they're cool.
No. Like, it just doesn't go with the rest of the uniform. Like, it doesn't flow for me. And not that I'm some fashion guru, but I think I know better than maroon with white and blue. It doesn't really go very well.
I mean, when you're putting a team like the Colorado Avalanche on the ice this year, I feel like you can get away with a lot. I mean, I kind of feel the same. Some people love the Golden Knights all gold uniforms. I personally, they're a little much for me, but I mean, you know, they've got the play to back up the bright pants, and even the helmets are a little bit off, I think. So, I mean, I'm all for it, as long as you can back it up on the ice, wear whatever you want.
Yeah, it's true. Okay, so one story that has been it's developed over the course of the night is Pierre-Luc Dubois in Columbus. So he plays, I think it was something like 4 minutes or something in the first period, and then does not see the ice for the rest of the game, which also included overtime, and he sat on the bench. If John Tortorella is sending a message, this doesn't feel like the right one.
You know, I mean, the whole situation is just weird. I mean, first of all, he signs an extension with the Blue Jackets in what? It was late December, I want to say. It was around New Year's, around the holiday, I thought. And then he comes out and says, you know, is publicly open to the team saying, hey, I don't want to be here anymore. I want to trade. So, I mean, I understand John Tortorella's frustration. I mean, Pierre-Luc Dubois, I want to say he's, what, 20, 21, 22 years old? You know, you put your heart, you know, you put a lot, you spend a lot of time and effort and resources into developing this player, and all of a sudden at 22, he doesn't want to be there anymore. I mean, if I'm John Tortorella, I'm pissed too. I got to be honest. And how do you come into the locker room every day and, you know, trust that this kid who doesn't want, his publicly said doesn't want to be here, is going to go out and play his best hockey? I mean, I don't blame him for keeping him on a short leash. As far as sitting him on the bench for most of the game, I mean, I would have just made him a healthy scratch at that. And, you know, everyone on Twitter is kind of saying, hoping for an in-game trade, which those are always exciting, you know, when you see the players just pulled off during the game. I mean, I do think he could have gone around it a little bit better and a little bit less humiliating, but that's Torts, and that, you know, he does things his way, as we all know.
The tough spot I feel like Columbus is in is, well, this relationship with Dubois is now fractured, and so you're going to trade him and not do, you know, they're probably not going to do great on a trade for a top six forward, you know, potentially a shutdown center who's young and, you know, will probably be very good for a long time. It just, this doesn't seem likely to end well for Columbus, because Dubois will outlive Torts' career. Like, Torts will be long gone as the Blue Jackets coach, while Dubois is likely putting up good numbers and playing good two-way hockey for another team. So it's just, it's a really difficult spot for Columbus to be in, and I'm not really sure what the easy answer is, because you could just say, well, fire Torts and mend fences with Dubois, but it doesn't seem like that's all that likely.
No, honestly, Columbus is back against the wall at this point. You have a kid that publicly said that he doesn't want to be there anymore. Teams are going to be interested in him, but, you know, the Blue Jackets are going to have a high asking price from a lot of these teams. I mean, I'm hearing my hometown Ducks are even in the mix, but, you know, with all the prospects that the Ducks have in their system, you know the asking price is going to be very high, and I don't think Bob Murray is going to want to give in to any sort of offer, any of the players they're looking for, like a Trevor Zegras or a Jamie Drysdale that you know are going to be in the minds of the Blue Jackets. I mean, I hate to say it, but they're set up to fail, I think, in this scenario. They're not going to get the return that they want just because other teams know that, hey, they're put in this spot. They got to get rid of this guy because you don't want to keep a guy around that doesn't want to be there. It's not good for the locker room. It's not good for morale. And fans don't want to cheer for a guy that doesn't want to be there. They're not going to buy his jersey. They're going to want him out too. So, unfortunately for a team that, I mean, they had a great showing in the playoffs last year. They had a lot of promise. I had them, I mean, if this team did stay together, I had them making one of those four playoff spots. It's just, it's unfortunate for the entire team.
And it's unfortunate for the organization, too. They've already had to deal with, you know, Artemi Panarin and Sergei Bobrovsky jumping ship. And you know, in hindsight, long term, yeah, maybe Jarmo Kekalainen should have dealt them. They did end up, you know, sweeping away the Tampa Bay Lightning, which is no easy feat. But it really has been an organization that's been kind of hard done by stars. And by all accounts, playing in Columbus, from what I've heard from some players, is just that it's a great place to play because you have that anonymity, the crowds are great, and you can kind of just go about your business. Obviously, Pierre-Luc Dubois wants a bigger stage. Artemi Panarin was the same because he went to New York. And Sergei Bobrovsky just wanted, you know, a boatload of money, which seemingly Columbus didn't want to ask. But this feels like an organization that's been really hard done by stars.
I mean, when you say that, I literally think back to the Jeff Carter trade back in, well, I want to say the summer of 2011, right before the Kings won the Stanley Cup. Well, the Flyers traded, they traded what, Jacob Voracek, and then the first round pick that ended up being Sean Couturier for the Flyers. And then Jeff Carter didn't even want to show up to camp. It was Rick Nash that had to convince him to come. And then he plays and then just flat out, you know, expresses how he doesn't want to be there. He gets traded to the Kings and, you know, the rest is history. The Kings win their first Stanley Cup. And, I mean, it's unfortunate because, I mean, I have friends in Ohio. They're very passionate about their sports. I mean, if you know football, I mean, Browns and Bengals fans are as passionate as you are as a Bills fan. And, you know, hockey is new for a lot of people there, just from what I've heard. But they're very passionate. They're dedicated to their team. And like you said, there's anonymity there. They can walk around, they can go get coffee, go to a restaurant, and will not get recognized. Now, Artemi Panarin might be able to do that in New York, just considering the dense population there, but like Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, you know, any city in Canada, you're not going to be able to do that. So a lot of players like that. A lot of players like being able to go out with their families and not be bothered and have that spotlight on them. I mean, I don't know if he's expressed any, what kind of market he does want. I guess that'll depend on, you know, I don't think he has a no movement clause. He doesn't have a say in this trade, does he? I didn't see any details in his deal.
No,
so
he doesn't.
They can ship him off wherever.
Well, I'm curious if you think like the NHL might be slipping into, I'm not going to say dangerous territory, but, you know, choppy waters with young players who are under contract. You know, we see it in the NBA certainly, and you know, we're starting to see it maybe a little bit more in the NFL. You think of somebody like Deshaun Watson coming to mind, where they're basically trying to force their way out of town. Is that a problem, or is it just a case of, well, the players need to try and exercise a little bit of will, power in any way that they can when they're generally speaking, especially younger in their career, it takes them a while to get to the point where they can reach free agency?
Absolutely. I mean, I do think it's something that, you know, you got to watch out for. I mean, less so with Deshaun Watson, but I mean, you know, you think about James, you know, James Harden, what he did out in Houston. He was like, oh, there was no, you know, love lost there. I love Houston. And then Boogie Cousins comes out and says, yo, man, like, you did not want to be here. Like, it was known in the locker room. You kept coming in here, and the energy was that you did not want to be a part of this. So don't say your heart is here. Don't say that. And honestly, when it comes, especially when it comes to younger guys, and you're still on that rookie contract, when you're still, you know, in your, wait, some of these kids, like, you know, early 20s, where, you know, you want to force your hand, and you're not even off your entry level deal here. So maybe it's a little bit where they're young and they don't see the impact and the rippling effect that they could have, that, you know, something like this could have on an organization and a team and a fan base. But, you know, kind of, and I'm all for athletes, if there's any mistreatment going on, if there's any, you know, waste, you know, I get it. It's frustrating sometimes when you feel like your career is being wasted, but it's, you know, finish out your entry level deal, you sign a contract, and then, you know, once you're a free agency, once you're an unrestricted free agent, you can sign wherever you want to.
Annie O'Donnell is our guest here from the OD on Sports podcast. For those that are listening, go watch what Nathan MacKinnon just did to Mikey Anderson. He literally undressed him and made him fall into the boards, and then the Avalanche proceeded to score a goal. Unbelievable stuff. I did want to focus on your hometown Ducks for a quick second here. It seems as though, like, I really feel for John Gibson because he's a really great goalie, and he gets absolutely no support. They've been in basically every game. Only, you know, only one of their four has been decided by more than one goal, and that was the first game against Vegas. But is this a matter of a lack of talent offensively, or is this just the way that Dallas Eakins wants to coach?
You know, with Dallas Eakins, this is his second year as an NHL head coach, so I'm trying not to base too much judgment off of there. I know he had success with the San Diego Gulls, our AHL team. I think, honestly, the Ducks are in this weird, they should, I'll call it what it is, because the fans have been in rebuild mode, I would say, since, what was it, the 2018-2019 season, when the Ducks literally won two games in December and January, and we didn't hear a peep from the front office or anything, and everyone was thinking Randy Carlyle was going to get fired any day. Didn't hear anything. So the fans have been in rebuild mode. We've kind of known, all right, you know, you got to clean house here, just wait for the young guys to get up to speed. But then this past offseason, Bob Murray goes out, picks up Kevin Shattenkirk, who he tried to get last season, but, you know, Shattenkirk wanted to go win a cup, which he did with Tampa Bay. And then he said, no, this isn't a rebuild. This is a retool. You know, this team is still capable of being top of the Western Conference, which, I mean, as fans, you just kind of sit there and go, what are you talking about? What team are you – are we looking at the same team here? Like, what do you know that we don't here? And I just feel like this organization kind of doesn't really know what stage they're in. And I get it. Rebuilds suck. I understand. It's, you know, you don't want to put a product on the ice for the fans that's not successful. But it's part of any organization. It's the roller coaster of, you know, the ups and downs. And the Ducks had their, you know, they had their window. You know, I would say, you know, they went to the Western Conference Final in 2015. You know, that window. And then, unfortunately, you know, after 2017, that was their last real go. And he's just got to call it what it is. He's got to call it a rebuild. And there's so much trust in these young guys. He's like, oh, I want to see how the Troy Terrys and the, you know, the Max Comtois do, which he's been playing great so far. He's our top goal scorer. And it just feels like a lot of pressure on young guys and just not a plan. It's not a plan to say, oh, we'll just see how they do. We'll see how they do on the ice. Like, that's not concrete. That's not a plan moving forward. Now, I like that we have Jamie Drysdale and Trevor Zegras playing AHL hockey, getting their feet wet a little bit before we throw them in. I know they expressed a lot of regret with putting Cam Fowler in too early, which that's also part of the reason we're talking blue lines. That's a little bit Cam's kind of plateaued, I want to say, in play. But I think, you know, the organization just needs to take a look at itself and say, hey, what do we want to do here? What's the plan moving forward? We're transitioning out of this era led by Ryan Getzlaf, who's in the last year of his deal. We'll see what he wants to do when his deal expires this coming July. But that's and unfortunately, Gibson's getting the grunt of that. He's constantly overlooked. I'm one of the biggest advocates of this. It's just so frustrating because I think about it like kind of like a football term. When you look at quarterbacks, you know, most analysts rank quarterbacks, you know, they kind of take out the offensive line in front of them, kind of the weapons they have, and they're like, okay, these are the best quarterbacks in the league. And that's why you always see Deshaun Watson up in, I've seen him in everybody's like top five. Whereas goalies, I feel like a lot of hockey analysts don't do that. And it's clear with John Gibson, because the NHL released this poll of, you know, all the top goaltenders and all these analysts picked. They put him at 14. Like, they put both Dallas goalies, they put Marc-Andre Fleury above him. I'm like, yo, like, this is is ridiculous here. Like, if you don't think John Gibson is a top elite goalie, you clearly have not seen him play hockey.
Unfortunately, Annie, that is the East Coast bias sticking out, because they don't watch a lot of Anaheim Ducks hockey, and John Gibson is definitely worth the price of admission. Listen, we've taken up a lot of your time. Thank you for giving it to us tonight, and we appreciate it as always, and we'll talk again soon.
Thank you so much for having me. Always a pleasure.
Annie O'Donnell, host of the OD on Sports podcast. And Josh, you know, there was a time that West Coast swing going through the California teams was an absolute gauntlet. And if you got out of there with 2 points out of six, you were happy. If you come out of there with, you know, not getting all 6 points, you're probably, you know, not happy with how that road trip went.
Yeah, it's different now, right? All of those teams. I like, if you had to pick one of those three, like, who do you think is closest to being respectable or back in the playoffs? Is it San Jose, considering they still have some of those holdovers, you know, Carlson and Kane, most notably, and obviously Hurdle as well? Or do you like what's going on in Anaheim more?
I think San Jose's time is done. I just think that they don't have enough young talent. But if you look at Anaheim, you know, it's not really a bad organization. Like, they've got a lot of depth in the organization. I just would love to see them, you know, put things together. Their defensive grouping is very good. You know, when you look at Fowler, Lindholm, and then they have Jamie Drysdale, and there's some talent there. Josh Manson's hurt right now, but there's some talent there. Up front, they're just not good enough right now. And maybe Trevor Zegras is a guy that can help push them in that direction. But there's been a lot of guys that have really struggled. Like, you expected, you know, when was the last time you heard from Jacob Silverberg or Ricard Raquel? You know, Annie mentioned Max Comtois has been really good. You want to see what you get from Sam Steele. Troy Terry's another one. But there's a foundation here. And John Gibson is the real deal. He just gets so overlooked because his teams are never any good. But if you have John Gibson, like, if you put John Gibson on the Leafs right now, how much more confident do you feel in that Leaf team?
Oh, my God. More confident. Substantially more confident. Like, you could make an argument that John Gibson might be a tad overrated because he's on a bad team and keeps them in games. I think he's a very, very good goalie. Do I think that he's taken them deep, deep into the playoffs the way that Freddie hasn't? You're probably more likely to, but I don't know how much more likely to.
I'm a big Gibson guy, so I'm a bit biased. So I will shelve that conversation for another day, but it's about that time. Producer Mark Boffo is getting the grill ready. He's just turning up the heat a little bit, and we're going to get it next. Boffo's Buffet of Topics coming up here on Sportsnet tonight on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Yeah, you got that yummy, 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 yummy.
What a song to kick off this segment. Welcome back to Sportsnet tonight on Sportsnet 590, The Fan of the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm your host, Matt Marchese. Alongside me, my co-host, Josh Goldberg. And I don't know if there could be better intro music for producer Mark Boffo and his Boffo's Buffet of Topics for this evening. Mr. Boffo, great job producing the show as always tonight. And welcome back to the airwaves.
Oh, thank you. Welcome back to the airwaves to you too, Maddie. It's been a while since we've done a show. So nice to have you and Josh along for the ride tonight with actually two Joshes, Mr. Santos behind the board too. So it's been a good night.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I'll let you get things going here with your buffet. What is first up on the menu?
All righty. Well, let's see here. You know what? I want to continue, just because you were talking a little bit about it with Annie, just a little update on the Pierre-Luc Dubois situation. We have quotes from Torts after the game. He said, "It's up to the player to show me. If you play the proper way, you're going to get out there." So obviously still a little bit cryptic, but sending a message one way or the other to Dubois. Where would you like to see Dubois get traded? Apparently, you know, more than 24 teams have inquired to the Blue Jackets about his services. What makes sense to you?
Well, the one team that does make sense, I just don't know if they can pull the trigger on a deal, is the Montreal Canadiens. They don't really have that number one center. And I'm still not convinced that Pierre-Luc Dubois is that guy. He might very well be. But when I look at that team, that's the type of guy that they're looking for. And of course, the obvious connection is that he's French-Canadian, and I understand that. But he's a bigger-bodied center. He can play in multiple different ways. He's not a guy that is just all finesse. Like, he can play physical. He can be that big body. And I just don't know if Montreal is willing to give up the package for him. And I don't know if it's going to be worth it in the end. Because if you got to give up Suzuki and a first, or Kotkaniemi and a first, maybe Kotkaniemi and a first makes sense. But if you've got to give up Suzuki and a first, I don't know if I'm doing that deal. But it would be Montreal for me.
Yeah, Montreal, I think, is definitely the one that jumps off the page. No question. You mentioned it. I think Winnipeg would be really, really interesting. I'm pretty sure his dad coaches in the system with the Moose, I believe. And, you know, I understand they have Scheifele and I believe Paul Stastny's contract is up at the end of the year. But hey, if you're going to trade Patrick Laine, which I think is fait accompli at this point, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they don't end up moving him. It seems hard to believe that there's a long-term solution there and they sign a long-term deal. How about a swap of some sort? I imagine there'd be other assets. I don't know how the NHL community views a trade with Dubois and Laine as kind of the centerpieces. That seems to make a fair bit of sense, and maybe the same issues would arise with Laine. Could you imagine Laine playing for Torts in Columbus? I don't know how well that one would go, but that one might make a little bit of sense. And then, you know, I saw Friege mentioned in 31 Thoughts, teams like Colorado and or Tampa getting involved. I don't know how Tampa could do it. You never know with them, but I'll never put anything past Julien Brisebois and finding a way to make that team better and skirting the cap and just figuring it out somehow to continue bringing in top-end talent. That seems unlikely. Colorado, you never know, but I'm on board with a Winnipeg and Columbus type of trade.
I'm with you. I think the Jets are very interesting. Just, you know, you just like to see that one-for-one swap of kind of stars, or like you said, other pieces might have to be involved. And, you know, Torts would be interesting there, but like you said before, it's one of those things where you make a move, you're probably going to side with the player in the long run. Coaches have a shelf life, and you got to think that Jarmo knows Patrick Laine as well as anybody and would probably have to can Torts if that wasn't a good partnership. So I'm with you. Columbus and Winnipeg is interesting to me. Moving on, guys, away from sports for a moment. Diet Coke was trending on Twitter today, and it was because now ex-president Donald Trump had a red button in the Oval Office that when he pressed it would summon a butler to bring him a can of Diet Coke, which I guess is his go-to drink. New President Joe Biden has since removed the button, but my question for you guys is, what would your go-to drink be if you could just have a button to order any soft drink that your heart desires?
Ooh. Firstly, Donald Trump drinking all those Diet Cokes certainly didn't help his weight, but there was one drink that growing up I loved, and I can't find it anymore, and that was Tahiti Treat, and I believe it was C+ that did it, or maybe it was Crush. I can't remember, but I think it was C+, and that was a go-to for me. But for now, right now, it would probably be Pepsi, and I would drink way too much of it, and then I may have be in the same weight class as the Orange President.
I've kind of, you know, not being a big pop guy in the last few years. I know it's horrible for me, so I've tried to cut back on it. I still treat myself every once in a while. If I had to choose one, it would probably be Dr. Pepper. If you could just continue giving me pop time after time after time, and maybe I just either didn't care, it wasn't that terrible for me, Dr. Pepper would be my number one. I could never get sick of it. That flavor explosion, it's just, there's so many different flavors going on. Always good. Dr. Pepper would be mine. Not in a can. It would have to be glass, ice, extra cold.
Do we just become best friends, Josh? Because I am right there with you. It would have to be Dr. Pepper for me, nice, as well. Or a nice frosty mug of root beer. It's a toss-up between one of those two for me.
Okay, hold on with the root beer thing. With the root beer thing, let's discuss this, because I'm glad that you brought that up. I don't know about you guys. Like, I'm on board with Dr. Pepper. I love Dr. Pepper. I don't know about you guys, but as I've gotten older and the taste buds have changed, I had A&W root beer, and A&W root beer is one of, if not the best. I couldn't finish it. It tasted legitimately like medicine to me. And my grandfather told me that same thing. When he was growing up, he loved root beer. And as he got older, he couldn't drink it because it tasted like medicine. I don't know if you guys have had that same thing, but maybe I need to try it again. It just didn't work for me.
A&W we're talking about?
Well, any root beer. I feel like I've tried another one, but A&W root beer was a go-to. It was so good. And I had it, I don't know, like a couple of years ago, I guess it was now, and I haven't had it since because it gave me such a bad taste because it tasted like medicine. It was disgusting.
Yeah, I could see, like, a root beer, it's a real acquired taste. Like, I like it. Mug is gross. I'm not drinking mug ever. It's honestly, that and brisk iced tea are at the bottom of the soft drink totem pole for me. I would sooner have a glass of milk before even considering having one of those two. But you know, if I do like root beer, but if I had to choose between the two, I would take Barks over A&W.
Again, in complete lockstep here. Barks is bite, amazing commercials growing up, amazing tastes. I'm right there. Let's go Barks.
100%.
But yeah. Haven't experienced the medicine sensation here, Marchese, but now you've got me a little concerned. All right, so moving on here. Alrighty. So it's Jack Nicklaus's birthday today, guys. He turns 81. And he still holds the record with 18 majors. Will Tiger, or anyone for that matter, break the record? And I thought Tiger, even with his injury woes, was going to do it. I just thought he would maybe slowly but surely at least tie him. But with Tiger getting another back surgery again, it just seems like it's a further thing away from a reality. What do you guys think?
I'll let you take this one first, Josh.
Yeah, I don't think so, unfortunately. You know, when things were that 2019 season, when he was from, like, you know, I guess like spring 2018 through the Masters of 2019, he was playing good golf. He was healthy, won a couple of times. You're starting to think, you know what? Hey, you got one here. If he can just stay healthy, looks like he's in good shape. Maybe he can win another one or two. Seemed unlikely that he would get, you know, the four more he would have needed after that, because he's now at 15 and Jack's at 18. He needs four more to break it. But now that he's had another back surgery, you know, and for a disc issue, I would just be happy if he plays again, let alone wins anything again. So to talk about somebody who's had four or five back operations, winning four more majors at the age of 44, 45, just not realistic. And anyone else, no chance. Like, if any other player gets to double digits, I would be surprised. There's just too much parity. There's too many great players in golf. It's too volatile. You know, guys go up and down. Rory McIlroy, we thought was going to get there, and I think he's got four. and hasn't won a major in going on 7 years. He won the PGA back in 2014 and hasn't won since. So it's difficult. You know, Justin Thomas has one. Dustin Johnson has two. Like, maybe Koepka. There was talk that Koepka could get there, but now he's gone a little bit cold, relatively speaking. I don't think anyone's getting close to 18, 19. I don't think anyone's getting close to Tiger's 15. And I honestly don't think anyone's getting close to 10.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. I just don't see it. His body's taking too much of a beating, and the time off was the killer for him, because when he took the hiatus away from golf, partially injury, partially personal, that was kind of some prime years that he missed out on. And now that his back and you know, he's just, there's just too much going on there. But I wanted to, it's funny that we mentioned Tiger Woods today and the whole Jack Nicklaus thing. I had a conversation with somebody earlier today, and it was about Tiger Woods. And I'm certainly not the biggest Tiger Woods fan. I appreciate what he's done for the game of golf. Like, he changed the sport. I get it. But is there an athlete that we have obsessed, that In their sport, that the fans of that athlete have obsessed about more than Tiger Woods? Like, we have the Tiger Tracker on Twitter, and when he's on, everybody's watching. Like, is there an athlete? The only other guy that comes to mind is LeBron James, and I don't even think it's close.
No, I would say Tiger, at least in my kind of adult life, or when I've been old enough to really take in sports. Yeah, there's nobody that transcends the conversation the way that he does. And yeah, when he plays, casual fans, obviously diehard fans, even maybe non-fans, at least are aware of it, if not watching it. For a sport like golf that has struggled for so many years to attract any sort of interest like that, yeah, there's been nobody like it. And I honestly, like, are we really going to see it again? We're just at such a different time in our society, where I just feel like, you know, people have too many other things. They're just maybe not as singularly focused on sports as maybe they were, 10, 15 years ago. We're getting cord cutting going on. People aren't maybe watching quite as much as they used to. I just feel like that type of athlete maybe is gone by the wayside a little bit.
Buff, what do you think?
Well, guys, speaking of transcendent athletes, I have to actually just break in here quickly. We've got some breaking news. The Cleveland Cavaliers are finalizing a trade to send Kevin Porter Jr. to the Houston Rockets. So I just wanted to pass that along. But
I saw that, and I was wondering if somebody was going to break in with that juicy piece of news.
Well, you know, just leave it up to me to be the idiot to do it. But it's coming from Sham, so you can take it to the bank. But I'm with you guys. In the long run, what Tiger did in the prime of his career, I don't think we'll... I hate to simplify it, but I don't think we'll ever see it again. I mean, he was on pace to shatter this record, and if not for, you know, the injury woes and whatever, I mean, you know, Father Time's undefeated. We always say it. So if he can't do it, nobody can, is kind of my opinion on it. And whether that's just way too simple of a way to look at it, I just think it's the correct take, unfortunately. I would have loved to have seen it happen, but it'll be tough. Speaking of tough, we got some tough guys in the octagon this week. Conor McGregor making his return. Does he still move the needle for you? How interested are you in this weekend's pay-per-view? And I recommend buying it, guys, because I don't know if you've heard, Dana White is cracking down on streamers. He said they have found one of the top illegal pirates, and he is just waiting for him to host the fight this weekend. What do you think of McGregor?
And just
weekend?
He's going to crack down on him and shut him down. I like that. Yeah. And you know, I'm generally speaking, I used to be maybe more of a proponent of it. But if there's something I really want to watch in terms of pay-per-view, I'll shell out for it. I don't pay for every single thing, every single card, boxing, UFC, or otherwise. But if there's one that I really want to watch, then yeah, I'll pay for it. I'm not going to... it's illegal and the quality is crap. If I really want to watch it, I'll shell out the... it's not cheap, but I'll still shell out the dough for it.
Yeah, and it's an interesting card this weekend. Like, there's some implications here. Like, does... Khabib wants to see who shows up for this fight. And while that's kind of a junk answer from Khabib, there's something at play here. Like, we could get Conor Khabib round two. So I'm very curious to see how this goes. And honestly, after watching some of the stuff with Conor McGregor, it seems like he's taken a different angle to this one. It seems like he's, you know, his training has taken to a different level. He's serious about getting back into this. So I'd be very curious to see what happens. And this one will be definitely worth a watch. And speaking of worth a watch, Nathan MacKinnon just absolutely ripped one past Jonathan Quick. Like, watching that guy play is something special. But sorry, Boffo, you got any more?
I got one more for you guys, but we all know that, you know, I'm not even going to turn on the Avalanche game because they're wearing those blue pants that you hate, so it's not even worth it.
They're pretty bad. They're terrible. Blue pants are pretty bad.
Okay, so last one for me here, guys. Josh, you mentioned during the show, after you spoke to Greg Thompson on the Bills, you said that the NFL is a better league when teams like the Bills are successful in making the playoffs due to their passionate fan base in previous years of futility. Who would be the NHL equivalent? Who's a team that you would like to see get back into the playoffs and, you know, give their fan base a little bit of hope going forward here?
Probably Detroit, in all honesty. I understand, you know, it's been rough after two decades of not dominance. Well, there was a lot of dominance, but at the end they were just kind of hanging on. But it's gotten real rough there in a real hurry. Like, they are brutal. And, like, I know they're often not a horrible start, but it's expected to be another long year. And they're slowly but surely putting it together. But I always think that original six teams being good and in the conversation and part of the playoff mix, it's good for the league. There's a reason teams like that. I'm pretty sure the NBC Sunday afternoon national game this week is Chicago-Detroit. There's a reason the national teams, even when they stink, and both those two teams stink, are still getting featured nationally in the States. It's because they drive the conversation, their fan bases are passionate, the television markets are good, they're good for ratings. I understand that's, you know, maybe not the sexiest pick in the world, but I think it's good for the NHL, and the NHL will be happy if you see a team like Detroit back in firmly in the mix for a playoff spot and back competing for a Stanley Cup.
Okay, I've got two, and one is along the lines of what Josh is saying about an original six team and their draw, and this one's a huge market, and that's the Rangers. And I think they're getting closer, but that's definitely a team that the NHL is better off when they're good. But one thing from the small town thing, it's got to be the Sabres. Like, they've been pretty irrelevant for about a decade now, and that's, you know, that city lives and breathes with the Bills, but they also do with the Sabres as well. And I've always enjoyed my trips going across the border and watching a Sabres game, whether they're playing. I don't even think I've seen them play the Leafs. I've seen them play other teams. And it's just, it's so good when they're relevant. And I like it when, you know, the Leafs and Sabres have that rivalry going. And obviously not this year because of the divisional format, but I like to see the Sabres at least be relevant, and they're getting better, you know, Jack Eichel and Taylor Hall together. But yeah, the Sabres definitely for me, just because their fan base has been through a lot in both sports, really.
No, for sure. I was thinking the Sabres too, and they just seem to have gotten the short end of the stick on so many things, right? You just look at that McDavid draft where they... It looked like they were going to be picking first overall no matter what. The ping pong balls don't go their way. They get Eichel, who's, listen, a phenomenal consolation prize. But, it just hasn't gone well for the Sabres. I'm with you, Matty.
All right, Boffo. Great stuff as always. And a great job putting the show together tonight, pal.
Appreciate it, guys. Have a good night.
All right, that's producer Mark Boffo, and we will wrap up our show question for this evening. The poll is finished, and we will see the results. Do you want to see the Canadian division return for another year? We'll find out the results of that poll when we come back on Sportsnet tonight, right here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Closing time. Open all the doors and let you out into.
Welcome back to the final block of Sportsnet tonight, right here on Sportsnet 590, The Fan and the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm your host, Matt Marchese, alongside me, Josh Goldberg. And Josh, we had our show question for this evening, and it was with what you've seen so far, would you like to see the Canadian division continue after this season? The poll is finished. 39.5% of our voters said hell yes, 34.4% said nah, and 26.1% said too early to decide. And I feel like the too early to decide, you know, about halfway through the season would change their tune to lean more towards hell yes, because you'll see those rivalries come through and you'll see you know, how much each game actually means, because every night is a 4-point night in this division.
Yeah, I just feel like at this point you would have a pretty strong inclination one way or the other. Like, you've seen enough of it. Yeah, I know it's only been a week, but pretty much you know what this thing looks like. It'll only get more intense. You know that it's already been pretty intense. If you like it, I would imagine you'd want it to stick around. And if you're like me and you want to have the variety and see all the other teams, then, you know, you appreciate it for what it is, but you want things to go back to the way they are as soon as it's safe to do so and as soon as that's possible. I'm not going to be convinced into it. Like, I have my position on this, and at this point, I feel like I'm not going to end up changing my mind.
Well, I'm telling you this. I am convinced that our time is up. Josh, great stuff as always. Pleasure working with you. We always have a ton of fun. And tonight was no different, my friend.
Good stuff as always, man. Appreciate it.
All right, that's Josh Goldberg, my co-host for this evening, and much thanks to all of our guests that joined us on the program, and our producer, Mark Boffo, and our technical operator, Josh Santos. That's it for us, myself included, Matt Marchese here. This has been Sportsnet Tonight on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, and the Sportsnet Radio Network.